two-party politics, two and a half perhaps, with the Liberal Democrats in England. Suddenly we have five-party politics. Anyone who tells you who's going to win the next election, don't believe them. But one thing is possible tonight is that it could be that Nigel Farage is a serious candidate to be Prime Minister of this country. Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Friday, the 8th of May. This is Today with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. Reform UK has gained more than 300 council seats in the first results from the local elections in England.
I do think that there is a very high chance of Nigel becoming Prime Minister. I very much hope that he will become Prime Minister. I think the next general election will be the most crucial in my lifetime.
Labour has suffered big losses.
It isn't just about losing the Labour government. We could be losing the party as a major force here.
Of course we've got to listen to what the British people are telling us.
Labour sources in Wales say they expect to lose power in the Senedd for the first time since devolution 27 years ago. And one other headline, American and Iranian forces have exchanged fire in the Strait of Hormuz, but President Trump says the ceasefire is still in place. And Nick, before we go any further, you've been here all night. Bring us up to date with what has happened that people need to know as they switch on this morning.
Well, it has been a night of drama, even though there's many, many, many councils still to begin counting, let alone to produce their final results. And we still have to have the results of the Scotland and Welsh parliamentary elections. But wherever you look, the news is bleak for Labour and particularly bleak for Keir Starmer, because Labour is losing large numbers of seats, has lost councils too. And if the polls are right, the prospect is of losing many more when those London seats are lost, squeezed by the Greens in the middle of London and by Reform on the outside. And indeed, in Scotland and Wales, there is a prospect of the party coming third in both of its traditional strongholds. Now, parties recover. Often parties of government recover after what are called midterm blues. But it is the emergence of Reform as a national force, pushing Labour into third in Scotland and Wales, as a national force making huge gains in traditional areas like the Lancashire mill towns, for example. Unheard of that in the Wiggins, for example, that you would get a whole series of gains from Reform UK. So we really are getting the repainting of the political map of the country.
And you also heard, didn't you, in the middle of the night, this debate within Labour about the future of Keir Starmer really bursting out.
An agonising debate, really, because what you might think after results like tonight, now this morning, is that someone would come along and say, I know what should happen, we should get rid of the Prime Minister. That wasn't really what we were experiencing. John McDonnell, yes, a critic of the Prime Minister, yes, a left-wing Labour MP, yes, someone who was very close to Jeremy Corbyn and part of that Corbyn project, did say, predictably you might think, that Labour needs to rethink and needs to include leadership in that rethink. But sitting alongside the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, you heard, and we'll play this clip to you a little bit later on if you didn't hear it during the programme itself, them agonising about the right approach. And what I took from that is no one has a simple answer. There's no new policy platform, no new individual simply waiting to be plucked out the air if only they can persuade Keir Starmer to move aside or to change course. They're going to have to spend a lot of time thinking, what on earth do we do now?
It's interesting for both the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. There were successes overnight, weren't there? There were places that they are going to point to over the course of the next 3 hours and say, look at that, yeah, we've done brilliantly.
Yeah, well, they are going to be able to point to places, and we'll go through some of the names of them. You'll hear them in the news bulletin in just a second. But that isn't what the vote share is telling you. When you look at the share of the vote, the Conservatives have had a pretty dreadful night. Now, they've got that old Tory jewel in the crown in central London, Wandsworth, the Mrs. Thatcher's favourite constituency and council, and they've got it back. And they may well get Westminster and they may get Barnet. And that will give them some comfort. But their vote share is dramatically down. They're the opposition. The government's unpopular. It should be up. The Liberal Democrats have made some gains. They've got Richmond on Thames, where they've got every single councillor in Richmond upon Thames. But again, despite the fact they can point to some places in the country, their vote share's pretty steady. There's only one party that's been making consistent gains everywhere so far. Remember, we've not had most of the London seats, so we've not seen the Greens' performance, really. Not enough of it to know how well they'll do and whether it's as well as they're doing in the opinion polls. But it is Reform UK that so far is doing well everywhere.
6:05, let us get a news bulletin now from Tom Saunders.
Reform UK has made sweeping gains in the first results from yesterday's local elections in England, picking up more than 300 seats so far. Labour has lost control of seven councils, including Hartlepool, where Reform won all the seats being contested. The Conservatives have lost more than 100 councillors, while the Liberal Democrats and the Greens have made modest gains. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports.
This is just an early, partial, English-only picture, but it is one making extremely bleak viewing for the Labour Party. Less than 2 years after winning a landslide majority at Westminster, the party is losing votes almost everywhere. The majority of the council seats Labour went into the night defending have gone. The only thing stopping the list of councils where Labour has lost control from being longer is that in some of them, not all of the seats were up for grabs, so it was not possible for Labour to lose its majorities. The main beneficiary has been Reform UK, which has had an excellent night. At this stage, its vote share is well ahead of any other party's. Reform has also made important gains at the expense of the Conservatives, in yet another sign that the traditional Labour-Conservative duopoly is more fragile than ever. The Liberal Democrats have gained majority control of Stockport and Portsmouth, but lost control of Hull, where Reform surged. The Greens have gained votes in many areas, though that has not translated into significant increases in councillors, albeit with their main targets yet to come.
Across England, there are still more than 4,000 seats to declare. Average turnout so far is 43%, up 8 percentage points on 2022, when the same seats were last contested. The Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy has called on his colleagues to stick with Sir Keir Starmer, saying, "You don't change the pilot during the flight." But the Labour MP, Rebecca Long-Bailey, said confidence within the party was low.
It's a really soul-destroying night. We've lost a large number of really good Labour councillors and candidates, and it's quite clear that we've been squeezed both from Reform and the Greens.
The deputy leader of Reform UK, Richard Tice, said he expected to see further gains.
Results all over the country are a complete rejection of the two main parties, a complete rejection of the smearing, the sneering, the libelling of Reform and the key people within it, and an endorsement of the success of the councils that we've been running.
Counting for the elections for the Scottish Parliament and the Senedd will begin this morning. Multiple Labour sources in Wales say they expect the party to lose the Senedd election for the first time since devolution in 1999. Here's our Wales correspondent, Hal Griffith.
After a campaign where Welsh Labour consistently trailed in third place in the polls, senior party figures now seem resigned to defeat. The Deputy First Minister, Hugh Waranka-Davies, said it had been a tough election for his party with a mood for change, while another former Welsh minister told the BBC Sir Keir Starmer should stand down if the results were as bad as predicted. All this before a single vote has been counted in the 16 newly formed constituencies, which will return six members each to the Senedd. Plaid Cymru and Reform led the way in the polls throughout the campaign, but neither is expected to win an overall majority. The first results are due at around lunchtime, but it may be several hours or even days before we know who will govern Wales, with every likelihood of collaboration or coalition negotiations stretching into the weekend.
In other news, the United States and Iran have exchanged fire in the Strait of Hormuz. Despite the attacks, President Trump has insisted the ceasefire between the two countries remains in place. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The US and Iran each accused the other of firing first in a further outbreak of fighting, which once again endangers the four-week-old ceasefire. The Pentagon said US warships in the Strait of Hormuz came under attack from Iranian missiles, drones and fast boats. The US said it retaliated with strikes on Iranian launches and command sites. The Revolutionary Guard Navy, however, accused the US of violating the truce first with what it called aggression against an Iranian oil tanker and another vessel. American officials are at pains to say the flare-up is not a resumption of the war. But despite Mr. Trump's current apparent preference for dialogue, each of these episodes further erodes the very tenuous peace while Washington and Tehran apply their dueling blockades in the hope of getting better terms in the talks.
A man's been charged after Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was allegedly threatened on Wednesday evening near his home on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk. Alex Jenkinson, who's 39 and from Stowmarket in Suffolk, faces two charges of using threatening or abusive words or behaviour. He's due to appear before magistrates in Norwich today. A special concert will be held at the Royal Albert Hall tonight to mark Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday. The event will feature music from his programmes, as well as stories and reflections from public figures. It'll be shown live on BBC One at 8:30. Here's our media correspondent, David Siliso.
In a short birthday message, Sir David Attenborough said,
I had rather thought that I would celebrate my 100th birthday quietly, but it seems that many of you have had other ideas.
Indeed, beginning with the Prime Minister, the thousands of birthday greetings and celebration are, he says, overwhelming. The main event tonight, a televised concert from the Royal Albert Hall. The evening, a musical look back at many of his most famous wildlife moments, and also a chance for friends, fans, and colleagues to say thank you.
David Siliso reporting.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Friend, fan, and colleague of David Attenborough, Michael Palin, will join us at 8:30 to pay tribute to Sir David on his 100th birthday at 6:11. Let's go over to the BBC Weather Centre. Elizabeth Rezzini is waiting for us there. Morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Nick. Well, it's going to be quite a mixed few days ahead. It's a very messy weather picture, all in all. The details still likely to change, so just keep an eye out on the BBC Weather app for your local area. But today it's feeling milder. There's a southerly wind. The best of the weather will generally be across the southern half of the UK. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, there's low pressure towards the north. It's just given us a couple of trailing fronts. It's quite a cloudy start. Some sunny spells here and there. Lots of dry weather across Scotland and Northern Ireland with more cloud building up through the day. But we should see some sunshine develop by the end of the day from the north and the west. And for southern and eastern Scotland, there will be some showers around. It will gradually turn less windy. Further south for England and Wales, then it's a mixture of cloud and some sunny spells. Brightest for eastern areas of England this morning with some early mist and fog. We're starting off in mid to high single figures for most. For Wales and the Midlands, then there will be a few showers on and off throughout the day. Elsewhere, it's largely dry with some sunny spells, a lot more sunshine developing later on through the afternoon, particularly towards coastal areas, and the winds are light. Top temperatures for Scotland and Northern Ireland, 10 to 14 degrees Celsius. Northern England and Wales, 13 to 16 Celsius. For the rest of England, 16 to 19 degrees, so warmer. Locally, as high as 20 degrees Celsius in the far south and the east. Overnight tonight, watch out for a chilly night, particularly across northeastern Scotland.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. It is 13 minutes past six. It's been a long, a dramatic night, and it's just the beginning. More than 5,000 councillors are being chosen in England. Only some of those councillors have had their votes added up and the council's declared. Many more will happen while we're on air and over the next few hours. And there'll be the beginning of vote counting for the parliaments in Scotland and in Wales. Now, as we started this election cycle, it was pretty clear that the SNP were going to keep control of Holyrood. But overnight, sources have told the BBC that the Labour Party is also conceding defeat in Wales. They believe that Plaid Cymru will win in Wales, so there will be nationalist parties governing both of those parliaments as well as in Northern Ireland. And there's the expectation that Reform will beat Labour, both in Scotland and in Wales. Let's review, though, the story of the night that we have had of those local elections. And it has been one of success for Reform UK. Now, it is early on. There's still many councils counting. But so far, Reform have gained more than 200 council seats. And Suella Braverman, former Conservative Home Secretary, who defected to the party and is now its education spokesperson, came on our overnight results programme and said from what she'd seen, the party was in a very strong position for the next general election.
I do think that there is a very high chance of Nigel becoming Prime Minister. I very much hope that he will become Prime Minister. I think the next general election will be the most crucial in my lifetime because the choice will be very, very binary. It will either be a left-wing coalition to take us into deeper poverty, open borders and humiliation on the world stage, or the chance to start the recovery.
It's been a grim, grim night for the Labour Party and for Keir Starmer. The party has lost 4 in 5 of the seats that they've been trying to defend and has lost control of 5 councils. And already the debate about what to do now has started. Here on Radio 4, we heard from the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, who sat in this studio alongside the former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, who, of course, was a key ally of Jeremy Corbyn. And they disagreed publicly about how the party should now respond.
So it isn't just about local councils, and I feel so sorry for those councils. It isn't just about losing the Labour government. We could be losing the party as a major force here.
Let's just be clear. In 2019, we were reduced to our biggest defeat since 1935. Keir Starmer brought us back to a victory within a term.
With more votes
within
than we actually
got. Within a term. Of course we must reflect, but let us not underestimate what he achieved after that devastating defeat.
You were relying on the electoral system that wasn't reflecting the votes on the ground. Have an honest debate.
That debate will go on, no doubt, through this programme as well. And a debate is likely to begin in the Conservative Party as well, because although they can point to the odd success like Wandsworth in London, overall they have lost councillors, they have lost vote chairs, and the Conservative shadow Scottish spokesman Andrew Bowie admitted it was a difficult night for his party too.
It's obviously not a great night thus far, but we are beginning to turn this ship around. It's not even been 2 years, Nick, since that cataclysmic general election. So we are beginning to make progress, albeit the tonight not being great and losing some fantastic good local councillors along the way.
It's been a pretty mixed night for the Liberal Democrats. Yes, they can celebrate taking Stockport in Greater Manchester, Portsmouth Council too. They lost their majority, however, in Hull, and their vote share has not really improved. The Green Party's made smaller gains, but we are still waiting for the results from many of the areas where they're expected to do well, particularly in central London. And throughout the next 3 hours of the programme, we will hear from representatives of all the major parties, including the Defence Secretary, John Healey, for the government, and Nigel Farage of Reform UK.
17 minutes past six. Let us turn to London, where all the councils are being contested. Carl Mercer is BBC London's political editor and is here in the studio. What can you tell us so far, Carl?
Sort of reflecting the picture nationally. You talked about the success of Reform. It looks like London is going to get its first Reform council. We fully expect them to take Havering out on the Essex borders. They're threatening to take it out of London as well and have a referendum to take it out of the capital. But also strong Lib Dem performance down in South West London, holding on to Richmond and Sutton. But disappointment for them, and actually something of a surprise that Labour managed to increase their share of the vote in Merton, which was one of Ed Davies' key targets, actually. So Labour holding on there and hanging on to places like Hammersmith and Fulham too. And you talked about the Wandsworth result. Tories become the biggest party in Wandsworth, but not taken control of it. And this was a totemic one for Labour last year. Margaret Thatcher's favourite council down in Wandsworth. Labour took it in 2022. This time round, the Tories now the biggest party there, but not in overall control.
It's this extraordinary patchiness, which I think we're going to be talking about throughout the rest of the programme of results, because that Richmond result that you referred to there, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, took every seat on the council. Which, you know, I think they did actually do that in 2022 as well, and they have traditionally been very strong down there. But I think for us, and you talk about the patchwork quilt, I think we're going to see a lot more of that later in the day. And I think, as Nick referenced, I think that green challenge in inner London is what is worrying the Labour Party in London.
And we don't yet know enough to know whether that has happened or not.
We don't know enough, but I was talking to Labour figures overnight and they said, look, the polls were bad, all of our briefing earlier was bad, but we are expecting it to be worse than bad. And I think that green challenge in those inner London seats, places like Hackney, Lewisham, were kind of baked into the Labour modelling, but we're hearing that there's going to be a challenge in places like Haringey, Lambeth, Southwark, large swathes of inner London that used to be Labour strongholds, one-party states almost, and they are really concerned that the green threat will surge in those areas.
Carl Mercer, thank you.
It's now 19 minutes past six. One aspect of the fallout of the elections will be how investors view the prospect for the country's finances. Sean Farrington's been taking a look at what's in store and has the rest of the day's business news for us, Sean. But we've been seeing in advance of these elections, haven't we, that the price that the markets demand for the money that the government needs to borrow has gone up, in part, it's thought, because of political instability and uncertainty.
Yes, over the last couple of months with the war in Iran and the idea that prices now are more likely to rise faster than they were before, that concept of prices being higher has meant many have thought interest rates won't be falling the way we expected at the start of this year and actually might be rising. And so all of that has actually led to a cost of borrowing increase for the UK government. And then in recent days, we've heard how investors are paying more attention to the political situation in the UK as well. So in the build-up to the votes that we've seen yesterday and what that might mean for the future spending, tax and borrowing decisions the country might take. Justin Unnecke is Chief Investment Officer at St James's Place. Justin, good morning. What is it that investors have been looking at with the political setup in the UK?
Morning. So the big challenge here is the volatility and the rise in borrowing costs, which tends to manifest itself when you have political instability. We thought with the general election, we saw a government with a majority. And even if you, no matter what your political leanings are, we had some certainty around a mandate for the next 5 years. However, what we are seeing here with all of the speculation on leadership challenges for both of the traditional parties is that you're seeing uncertainty and therefore you're seeing borrowing costs become more volatile due to that uncertainty.
And so is the borrowing cost moves that we've seen in recent days, is that linked to the politics around the leadership of those parties, or is it the fact that other parties may be having more of a say on the direction the country takes?
I think it's hard to detangle the two, actually. So firstly, you're seeing the rise of, in particular, Reform, and it's unclear what their policies, their forward focus is going to be, because we haven't seen a clear manifesto in terms of how they're going to balance the books. But at the same time, you are seeing speculation, particularly around the Labour Party, around the leader and who the leader is going to be. And therefore, there's uncertainty around the mandate, even of the current government. But the last thing is, as you mentioned right at the beginning, it's also hard to detangle the UK situation with the rest of the world, where you are seeing inflation costs go up, which typically has a negative impact on bonds as well and borrowing costs.
So what are you going to be keeping an eye out for today, Justin, as more results come in, more reaction comes in as well?
Yeah, there's two key things I'd be looking at. It's that borrowing cost for the UK government, so UK gilt yields in particular, but also the volatility of sterling. It's still early days yet. It's clear that the Labour government so far and the Conservatives, the traditional parties, have suffered so far, but it's still very early days. And in particular, we're looking at the London results and then the impact on markets on the back of that.
Justin, just changing tack a bit to artificial intelligence and the various impacts that's having on things. The Financial Times reporting just in the last hour or so that Anthropic, the business behind Claude, is considering raising tens of billions of dollars this summer to fund a big expansion in its computing capacity. capacity, could, you know, make it worth more than OpenAI, could be valued at almost $1 trillion. More of these big numbers out there. Does this feel like a solid base for growth, and the artificial intelligence growth that we've seen in recent months and years isn't going anywhere yet?
Well, it's definitely not going anywhere. But the concern has to be the amount of expenditure that we're seeing now on AI. There will be clearly some winners, and the winners will do very well. The companies will do very well. But clearly a lot of that expenditure isn't necessarily going to be productive, and there are going to be a number of losers. It used to be a few years ago, if you mentioned AI in your quarterly results or your yearly results as a company, the market would cotton onto that and it would be positive. Now more and more analysts are questioning what the spend is on AI and actually questioning how productive it's going to be. So that's likely to continue. The spending is likely to continue, but the scrutiny is also likely to continue.
Justin, thank you. Good to talk to you this morning. Justin Onukasi there, Chief Investment Officer at St. James's Place. Some of those thoughts that Justin mentioning about the world of AI reflected in Felicity Hannah's interview with Andy Briggs, the chief executive of the pension and savings business Standard Life, one of the UK's biggest investors. This in the latest episode of Big Boss Interview. He's been talking to Fliss, saying that the company's keeping a relatively modest investment in US big tech amid what he calls an interesting shift to them using debt as funding.
What's really important is to have a very diversified range of investments and not be overly exposed to any one sector. People worry, for example, about an AI bubble. And so what we make sure, while we obviously have investments in you know, on behalf of our customers into, you know, some of the, say, for example, the big US tech stocks, you know, we keep it to a relatively modest proportion. So they have a very diversified range of investments. And so I think the key message I'd say to customers is make sure you have a diversified range of investments and look at it over the long term. Don't get overly concerned about short-term volatility. Pensions is a long-term game.
Does that mean that you're worried about an AI bubble if you're limiting your exposure to those big tech stocks?
So I think that there's always risks of bubbles in different areas. In many ways, I think if you look at the AI side, I think what's interesting there is that a lot of the funding going into it is now debt-based. So that would have, you know, far less of an impact in terms of our customers. But when it becomes debt-based, you have to have a stream of cash generation in order to pay that debt interest. So I think that does start to become potentially more interesting. We still have an allocation to tech stocks. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that it's really important. There's a very diversified range of investments across multiple sectors, multiple countries, multiple asset classes, including an allocation to private assets as part of that. We think that's what will get the customers the best diversified returns.
We spoke to the St. James Place CEO on this podcast. He told us that around the time of the Rachel Reeves budget, or before that budget, people were drawing down their pensions. Did you see that kind of behaviour?
Yes, we did. Fortunately, it wasn't anything like as bad in 2025 as it was in 2024. But this goes exactly to the point, Felicity, I was making earlier, that consistency is really important. So we feel very strongly that pensions needs a long-term, sort of multi-decade, cross-party consensus on the strategic direction. It is not something that should be speculated about in each budget, because what happened is there was speculation that people can get a quarter of their pension pot tax-free, and there was speculation that that would be removed. What then happened as a result, particularly in 2024, is lots of customers ended up taking their tax-free cash, the quarter tax-free, because they were fearful that benefit would be removed. It wasn't removed. And then what happened is subsequently those customers had that money then in a taxed environment rather than a tax-free environment. And in a situation where people don't have sufficient provision for a decent retirement, we can't afford to then make them worse off and have things that make them worse off. So it's really critical that there is consistency over time and there isn't speculation in each budget cycle that will be tinkering around with pensions.
So that's Andy Briggs, the chief executive of Standard Life. Catch more of that on BBC Sounds on the Big Boss Interview. Right, to the high street now. We've got Anna Blackburn with us, who's managing director of Beaverbrooks, 106-year-old family-owned jewellers, over 80 stores across the UK, 20 of them on the high street. Anna, good morning to you.
Good morning.
These latest numbers we've got about how many people were hitting the shop over March and April, down 3.9% according to the British Retail Consortium compared to last year. Yeah. You've seen the same?
We are. We're seeing slightly lower footfall, actually. Obviously, as a luxury purchase, and we're more considered, we've definitely seen a challenge with footfall, certainly in the last couple of months. But it's an ongoing trend. It really is a reduction in footfall on the high street.
So, yeah, what is this ongoing trend then? Because many might think, there's been a price squeeze in the last few months, or we know there might be price rises further down the line, so that might hit confidence. But this is longer than that.
This is longer than that. I think I've been in the industry for 28 years now, and I think it's the longest period that we've seen. I think low consumer confidence over the last couple of years, but certainly since COVID, we've been seeing, after the COVID bubble initially, since then we've definitely been seeing a reduction in footfall. But the customers that we're seeing are spending more, so people are still celebrating. We are still holding turnover, but I think we are seeing less customers, and that is definitely a downward trend.
That's interesting. So does that mean that is there a divide that's getting bigger between those that have and those that don't?
I think what we're seeing is people are prepared to spend on luxury for the right product, the right service. People are still celebrating their milestones. They're still getting engaged and married. But I think we're just seeing it as a more considered purchase. We're seeing more repeat visits. But definitely, yeah, with prices increasing, with obviously gold prices and inflation, we are definitely seeing, as I said, less customers, but they're spending more when they are. So I think what we tend to see is during difficult times, people invest more in those products that are going to last a lifetime.
Just finally, Anna, you know, we saw last week Claire's Accessories, 150 stores closing or so. This week we've heard out the 150 mm-hmm. old WH Smith stores may well be closing. Do you sense there's going to be more store closures on the high street throughout this year?
Yeah, I think what's happening with increasing costs and pressure on profitability across the retail sector, I think people are trimming their tail and they are closing stores and they're consolidating into the bigger out of towns, the bigger, you know, and it's the high street that seems to be suffering. But I think what we're seeing, again, the trend that we're seeing is where we're seeing councils who are proactive, who are reinventing the high street and adding sort of more entertainment, more residential. We're seeing those high streets doing okay. But where there isn't the investment, where there isn't the confidence, then yeah, there is definitely more challenge on the high street.
Anna, thank you. Good to talk to you this morning. Anna Blackburn there, Managing Director of Beaverbrooks.
Sean, thank you very much. Let us turn at 29 minutes to 7 to the Sport and Mike.
Just before we do, there's a little bit of news coming in from the elections. We'll bring you the results as we can. Reform UK have won many councillors, but up till now have not won a council. That is in part because most councils that are counting only count a third. So it is actually numerically impossible for Reform to win many councils, even if they win every seat. But they have won one. It's just been announced. Newcastle under Lyme. Not the Newcastle you're probably more familiar with in the northeast of England. This is in the West Midlands in Staffordshire. Reform UK have taken that council, not from Labour, but from the Conservatives.
There you go, Mike. Follow that.
Well, we can stay in Birmingham, at least, because it was a big night for Aston Villa last night, who confirmed their place in the Europa League final in style.
Bypasses Watkins, McGinn again! McGinn in a double! Aston Villa have rattled in a fourth goal! Sheer delirium inside Villa Park! Get the invites ready to Istanbul! Aston Villa, Europa League finalists!
Yes, an emphatic 4-0 semi-final second leg victory for Aston Villa over Nottingham Forest last night propelled them into the Europa League final. Here's Ian Dennis.
Aston Villa swept aside Nottingham Forest as they eased their way into their first European final in 44 years. It was thoroughly deserved. They were the superior side and were always in control. Watkins levelled the tie after 36 minutes after fine work from Buendia. Milenkovic gave away a penalty before the hour, dispatched by Buendia. Villa had a goal disallowed before then two quick goals from John McGinn sealed it. Both first-time finishes, one into the far corner, the other inside the near post. It was a special night and a great atmosphere. They will hope for more success in Istanbul against Freiburg on the 20th of May.
So Aston Villa through to the Europa League final. We already know that Arsenal are in the final of the Champions League. And there will also be a third English club in a major European final this season.
What a night at Selhurst Park! We said it was going to be the most prestigious evening in this old ground's history. And it's turned into one of the very greatest, because the Eagles will play in a major European final.
Yes, quite the night for Crystal Palace last night, who beat Shakhtar Donetsk 2-1 on the night to win their Europa Conference League semi-final 5-2 on aggregate.
Fantastic atmosphere, great night here at Selhurst, great European night, and of course with the right result, huge achievement, huge congratulations and credit to the players.
That is the Palace manager, Oliver Glasner. They will now face the Spanish side Real Vallecano in Leipzig in the final on the 27th of May. The football continues later this evening. The Championship playoffs get underway with Hull City hosting Millwall. And 5 weeks today, the World Cup will officially be underway. This is the big news this morning. Nick and Justin, I know you're particularly excited about this because the official song of the tournament has been unveiled. We know this, isn't we? This is Shakira. Colombian superstar has recorded her third World Cup anthem. This one is called Die Die. Comes from an Italian expression that apparently translates as come on, come on. It's out next week. Also features Nigerian singer Burna Boy.
And you knew that too?
Yeah, exactly. I'll be buying it. I think slow burner, I think.
Yeah.
We'll hear it a lot this summer.
But look, it's quite three English teams in three European finals.
It's incredible.
It's an incredible moment.
Fancy seeing you here.
Well, I live here on BBC iPlayer.
There's more to me than meets the eye. I'm actually reading 1984 at the moment.
I recommend Handmaid's Tale.
Love anything handmade.
Amanda's back.
She came, she saw, she gentrified.
You can't just confront someone like Amanda with reality.
Your dog clearly fancies me.
I've seen this before, albeit on human men, but it's definitely a thing.
The new series of Amandaland.
My mother's basically brunching away through my inheritance.
I'm meeting a man for coffee.
Honestly, I can't move for hot toddy.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Time now, 24 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb and Tom Sanders with the news.
Reform UK has made significant gains in the first results from the local elections in England, picking up 325 seats so far. Labour has suffered substantial losses, failing to hold on to almost half of the seats the party was trying to defend. Almost 250 Labour councillors have lost their seats. Reform have just won their first council of the night, Newcastle-under-Lyme in Staffordshire, which was previously held by the Conservatives. There's still a long way to go, with close to 100 councils not due to declare until later today or even tomorrow. Labour has held on to 10 councils, but it's lost control of 7, including Hartlepool, where Reform won all the seats being contested. The Conservatives have also had a bruising night, losing almost 120 seats. The Liberal Democrats have made some gains, winning Stockport and Portsmouth. The Greens have also picked up some seats, with results for their main target areas coming later today. Average turnout across England so far is 40%, up 8 percentage points on 2022, when the same seats were last contested. Counting in the Scottish Parliament and Welsh Senedd elections won't begin until later this morning, but Labour sources have told the BBC they expect to have lost the vote in Wales for the first time since devolution 27 years ago. In other news, Washington and Tehran have blamed each other for renewed hostilities in the Strait of Hormuz. The US said it struck Iranian military facilities after three of its warships came under what it called an unprovoked attack. Iran said it acted in retaliation. President Trump has said the ceasefire remains in place. A man's been charged after Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was allegedly threatened near his home on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk. Alex Jenkinson, who's 39 and from Stowmarket in Suffolk, faces two charges of using threatening or abusive words or behaviour. And Sir David Attenborough turns 100 today. A celebration concert at the Royal Albert Hall, featuring music from his programmes, will be broadcast live on BBC One this evening.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is now 22 minutes to seven. The people have spoken, voting in their millions in English local elections and in Scottish and Welsh parliamentary elections. The counting for those yet to begin. But what can we learn from what we know so far of those votes counted in England? We're joined by the Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde, the BBC's election guru, Professor Sir John Curtis, who's had a long night but has plenty to tell you. And joining us from Downing Street, our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeftman. A good night, a very good night for Nigel Farage's party, John.
Yeah, definitely a good night. And certainly it's pretty clear that Reform have been ahead in terms of the votes cast that were counted overnight, as well as being ahead in terms of seats. But I think, you know, the other obvious headline beyond that is there seems to be a clear underlining of the fact that we are living in a world of fractured politics, because trailing behind Reform are four parties: Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat and the Greens, who are all typically running at around 15 to 20% in terms of their share of their votes so far. And it's very difficult to separate them. But of course, in our electoral system, coming first brings its own rewards, and it's enough to for the Reform to be picking up at least one in three of the seats that have been declared so far.
Let's talk about the impact on the Labour Party in a second, but you've done some interesting analysis about Brexit voting areas and Reform. You've always said this, haven't you?
Yeah.
That referendum's got a very long tail.
It's got a very long tail indeed. Well, we already know from the according to the opinion polls that support for the Reform is running at about 50% amongst those people who voted for Brexit. It's running at about less than 10% amongst those who are opposed. Essentially, Reform have taken from the Conservative Party the coalition of people who voted for Boris Johnson to get Brexit done in 2019. And what do we discover when we look at the geography of where Reform do well? It's the places that voted most strongly for Reform. So to give you some idea of how dramatic it is, places where more than 60% of people voted for Brexit, Reform on average are running at 40%. In places where fewer than 40% voted for Brexit, Reform are averaging just 10%. Oh, and of course, in the case of the Greens, the pattern is exactly the opposite. And the Greens are primarily doing well in places that are much more pro-remaining.
So that brings us to Labour. And through the night, there have been places where, you know, you just assumed anybody with a red rosette got elected. Wigan, for example, that came up, where the Labour Party's getting a kicking.
Yep. And it seems to be getting a kicking from Reform. But actually, the picture is a little bit more complicated. Because if you actually look to see, well, OK, how much damage do the Greens do if they do particularly well to Labour as compared to the damage that Reform do? And the answer is that a good rise in Green support does more damage to Labour than does a good rise in Reform support. OK, so it has to be aware, therefore, that although Labour are losing more seats to Reform, they may not be losing more votes to Reform. And almost undoubtedly what's happened in some of these places is, yes, Labour has lost some votes to Reform. It may still have lost more votes to the Greens. But Reform, of course, also are taking seats votes away from the Conservatives, whose vote is down by 12 points on 2022. And those things in combination can leave Reform ahead. Because again, one of the things we should bear in mind, most of the wards that have been won last night have been won with relatively low shares of the vote. There are lots of narrow contests, but given that you can see how these kinds of seemingly counter movements are often enough to put Reform ahead.
Talk to Henry in just a second about what Downing Street are making of it and what people are making of Downing Street. But for people waking up and thinking, well, I thought the Greens were doing so well. It's early days, isn't it? We haven't.
Well, it is early days, but frankly, you can also see the problem, and it's a problem that some of us did point out in advance of the elections. So basically, the Reform are typically, on average, running at around 18% or so in the wards that they have been fighting, which is most of the wards. It's a credible performance. But under our electoral system, where you haven't developed any local fiefdoms, local areas of strength of any great note, that just means you're going to come second and third very, very often. And that seems to be what's happening to the Greens. And one suspects that this is also what's going to happen to the Greens in London, where certainly the polling suggests that although Labour's vote is well down, that the Greens are still going to be trailing second. And second, isn't good under our electoral system.
Yeah, you can pile up votes. Liberal Democrats used to find that. UKIP found that. Now the Greens are finding it. Pile up votes without getting many seats. Let's turn to Henry Zeftman then, our chief political correspondent. What do you sense Keir Starmer is thinking of doing and saying about this, Henry?
Well, he is going to say something in the next few hours, Nick. I'm in Downing Street, where the Prime Minister is at the moment. But later in the morning, we will hear from him in one of the parts of the country where Labour has not necessarily done that badly. I'm told that he will not seek to duck responsibility. There's certainly the sense I get is that he doesn't want to give Labour MPs the impression that he's in denial. He would acknowledge that the results are clear, that there are really deep frustrations in various parts of the country with his Labour government. And then I think the message will be similar to that which we've heard from Sir Keir Starmer in the context of other setbacks, which is that he wants to deliver on the manifesto one-word slogan of change, and that he believes the government needs to go further and faster to do so. What I think some of the Labour MPs who I've heard from as they've woken up to some of these results this morning want to hear from Sir Keir Starmer is a clearer argument than before that he actually has a plan to ensure that people do feel they're getting that change.
Do they have a plan, his critics, to replace him? Because there's been lots of muttering about what Wes Streeting would do and what Angela Rayner would do and what others might do in this predictable scenario. Are they going to do it?
I don't think there is some ready-made, prefabricated plan ready this morning. But I also would not discount the possibility that as we get the vastly greater set of results that haven't yet declared over the course of today and to some extent over the course of Saturday, I wouldn't discount the possibility that there is just a sort of emotional chaos in the Parliamentary Labour Party. Certainly that is the sense I get from some of the people I've spoken to this morning. I mean, the names tend to boil down to Wes Streeting, Angela Rayner and Andy Burnham. One thought that strikes me this morning with regards to Andy Burnham, picking up on some of the trends that John was describing there, especially in various parts of the northwest of England, well, Andy Burnham would have to fight a by-election in order to become an MP. What is the seat right now at Westminster that the Labour Party could be confident of winning a by-election in, especially in the northwest of England? So that becomes, I think, part of the dynamic here. I think another thing that will be playing into how Labour MPs digest these results is just that some of the parts of the country where the Labour Party has been dealt real blows by Reform UK, even if they're not necessarily losing those votes directly to Reform UK, are some of the parts of the country where they have their most prominent figures. Tameside, where Angela Rayner is an MP for part of that. Well, Labour was defending 17 council seats and lost 16 of them, all to Reform. Or Wigan, where the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, sometimes spoken of as a leadership contender as the MP, Labour lost all 22 of the seats it was defending to Reform. It's things like that, actually, which I think almost as much as the overall national picture will sit uneasily with Labour MPs as they begin to digest the implications of these results.
Not just Keir Starmer, who's got an awful lot of thinking to do. Henry Zeffman, thank you for now. Professor Sir John Curtis, thanks.
14 minutes to seven. There is some other news around this morning, including what appears to be a serious exchange of fire between the US and Iran near the Strait of Hormuz. Fresh Iranian attacks as well on the United Arab Emirates. Let us talk to Yolande Nell, a Middle East correspondent who joins us from Jerusalem. Bring us up to date, Yolande.
Yeah, so the whole order of events in the Strait of Hormuz is not exactly clear overnight, but the US military said it intercepted Iranian attacks on three Navy ships. These were unprovoked Iranian attacks. And it said that in response, it targeted Iranian military facilities that had carried out the attacks on US forces. These were this was a response in self-defense. None of its ships were hit. The Iranian version of events is that US forces targeted an Iranian oil tanker in its coastal waters and a second vessel. Of course, the US has been maintaining a naval blockade of Iran. And Iran said that the US then hit with airstrikes on civilian areas, mainly in the south of the country, including Qasem Island, which is in the strait itself. President Trump then came out telling reporters in Washington that the ceasefire was holding. Despite this exchange, he said they trifled with us, we blew them away. And later, speaking to one US journalist, he described what happened with the Iranians as just a love tap. But then a sign this morning that this confrontation is not over, because the United Arab Emirates Ministry of Defense said early this morning its air defences were dealing with missile and drone attacks coming from Iran. And there have been no immediate reports from the UAE about damage there.
Do we know this morning whether the US effort to get any ships, commercial ships, through the strait is still in operation or not?
I mean, that was suspended, the so-called Project Freedom, by President Trump. And there has been some other sort of worrying news on that front, with Lloyd's List coming out saying that it had been given an application form. It had been contacted by a new government agency apparently created in Iran called the Persian Gulf Strait Agency. And it looks like this has been set up by Iran to vet, to tax vessels trying to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. And this seems to be another, you know, part of the Iranian effort to try to increase its control over this critical waterway. Will raise lots of concerns, of course, about what happens to international shipping, because you still have hundreds of ships that have been stuck. They're basically bottled up inside the strait since the outbreak of hostilities back on the 28th of February. And, you know, maritime law experts are saying that this, you know, move by Iran violates international law, but it just shows you how much the control of the strait has moved center stage in the ongoing ceasefire deal talks.
Yolande, thank you.
It is now 11 minutes to 7. The World Health Organization says an outbreak of hantavirus on board a cruise ship is not the start of a pandemic, but efforts are underway to trace anyone who may have been exposed to the disease. Hugh Pym, our health editor, joins us now. The WHO, Hugh, have said that there is no cause for concern.
Well, that's the message yesterday at their press conference, Nick, the WHO, answering a lot of questions from journalists, aware that there was a huge interest in what was going on with MV Hondius and the hantavirus outbreak. And perhaps the most animated part of the press conference was over questions, was this in any way similar to COVID? And was a pandemic looming? And there was a very strong statement, this was not another COVID-19, this would not be another pandemic. This would be a limited outbreak as long as all public health measures were followed closely. And by that, what's meant is tracing contacts. And the particular focus of governments who had citizens on board is a group who left the cruise early at the island of St. Helena and then went their own separate ways. And that included a group of seven British people, two of whom are back in the UK. And of course, when they left the ship, they didn't know about the virus. These two Britons got home, heard about the story, got in touch with health authorities, and they're now self-isolating. And five other Britons, some of whom are still on the island of St. Helena, are in touch with British health authorities. And the point is, they were on planes, this group, going to lots of different countries and sitting next to people. So the contact tracing task is now underway, trying to make sure that those who are in close proximity to people who got off the ship early are traced. And I think that's what's meant by public health measures being followed. In the meantime, the Foreign Office and other bits of the British government are looking at Britons who are still on the cruise ship heading for Tenerife. There will be arrangements made to get them home with a charter flight, we understand, being laid on, and they will be taken home. Then they will have to self-isolate or go into quarantine. We may hear more details about that later today. And that self-isolation could be 6 weeks for these people coming off that cruise ship. But more details, no doubt, over the next few days.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
9 minutes to seven this week on the programme. We've been celebrating, as you will know, the life of Sir David Attenborough. That is because today Sir David is 100 years old. We've been hearing reflections from well-known friends, fans of his work, also listening back to some of the great moments of his very, very extensive broadcasting career. Here is Chris Watson, the musician and sound recordist, telling us about one of the many times he's worked with Sir David on Frozen Planet in 2011.
David and I have had so many adventures over the years. I was thinking about this just the other day. We've actually spent time together at both poles, the North and the South Pole, and lots of places in between. And the thing about filming is there's an awful lot of standing around, not doing very much. And so we just spent those times in the most wonderful conversations and exchanges. And of course, the one that really sticks in my mind is when we were doing Frozen Planet back in the day, but I was standing at the North Pole with David Attenborough.
Up here, it's easy to see why the polar regions are so cold. The sun never rises high enough in the sky to warm my back. And those rays that do strike the surface are mostly reflected back from this great whiteness.
And the camera crew, we'd been taken there by a Russian military helicopter, and we were dropped at the North Pole. And then the camera crew went off. They flew off. And I said, look, you know, we can't just leave him here on his own. I'll stay here. And we were spinning round, not that we could feel it, but at the North Pole, we were revolving with the polar currents. And we looked down and we imagined all these people, all our friends around the world, living their lives at different times. So the evening in North America, the middle of the night in Europe, and the following day in Australia. And we just looked at each other and said, well, we're standing where every time zone on the planet converges. So what time is it at the North Pole? And we just, I remember just looking at each other and just astonishment and awe in where we were at that moment, the only two people on the planet standing at the North Pole, just wondering what the time was.
That was Chris Watson remembering working with Sir David Attenborough, who is 100 today. And that brings us to 7 minutes to seven. And let us get back to the drama unfolding overnight in local elections in England, which the Liberal Democrats have some successes to celebrate. They took control of Portsmouth. They had a blowout victory in Richmond, West London, where they now control all 54 seats. The Greens losing 5 seats they held there. Let us talk to Daisy Cooper, the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. Morning to you.
Good morning.
And let us start with Richmond, because I imagine you want to start there, and there are plenty of other less good results to talk about, but that is quite an extraordinary one.
It certainly is, and it's testament to what a good job our local Liberal Democrat councillors have been doing down there. But as you say, as well as winning in Richmond, we've also wiped out the Conservatives in neighbouring Sutton. We've won seats off Labour and the Conservatives in Stockport. We've fended off Reform in Hull as well. So quite frankly, we're really delighted with the results we've had come in already, and we think our best are yet to come.
How, though, can you be delighted when your share of the vote is appearing, at the moment at least, to be down several percentage points since 2022. In other words, you are going nowhere when it comes to inviting support around the nation as a whole.
That's not right. I mean, you don't get to change a community by riding high just in poll shares or vote shares. You change communities by winning in the ballot box. And what we've shown overnight already is that we are winning in the ballot box in all sorts of places around the country.
Yeah, exactly. in some places, absolutely. But in some places, you're completely not there at all. And I suppose that then leads to the thought, is that actually now the future for the party, where you concentrate on those areas where you can win, but the wider battle you're not really part of?
I think we have shown that we are up for winning hearts and minds everywhere across the country. But there's no doubt that when you have a five-party system in a first-past-the-post voting system, then, of course, it comes down to a bit of targeting. And I think all political parties would acknowledge that. And all political parties have been targeting in that way. We're no different from anybody else. But what I can say is that our targeting was hugely effective at the last general election, when we got our best result ever in the history of the party. And it's proving to work overnight as well.
Do you need to be more salient, though? Because when you think of the Liberal Democrats now, and you think of a situation where a government is hugely unpopular at almost any stage in our recent political history, I'm going back decades now, the Liberal Democrats would gain from it in terms of total vote share, and you haven't. And does that mean that there needs to be a rethink, or you just stick to things as they are?
Well, look, we are not noisy like the populists because we're not pursuing a politics of noise and division. What we are doing is we are winning and leading the battle of ideas. If you look at what is going on in our politics at the moment, it's we Liberal Democrats that are calling for a closer relationship with Europe. It's we Liberal Democrats who are calling for defence bonds so that we can shore up our country and defend our country. It's we Liberal Democrats standing up against the huge damage being caused by Donald Trump and issuing that warning that Trump's America could become Farage's Britain. So we've taken a very strong line on lots of different issues, which I think is resonating with people up and down the country.
Could you take a stronger line on Europe? I mean, could you just campaign as let us rejoin the European Union as soon as we possibly can, and at least make yourself clear then that there is a constituency of people who would agree and would go for you?
We have been very clear that we want the UK to be back at the heart of Europe. We haven't hidden that ambition at all. But we're also pragmatic people. And we know that just simply rejoining the EU, that isn't something that is on offer at the moment. It's really hard to overestimate the damage that was done by Boris Johnson and his tweeting diplomacy. We Liberal Democrats have set out a path for putting the UK back at the heart of Europe. That starts with the customs union.
OK, Daisy Cooper, Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems. Thank you.
Now let's take a look ahead to tomorrow night.
BBC Radio 4 explores a groundbreaking interview series.
It sort of doesn't really matter who Anthony Clare is talking to. I just want to be in his company.
Through the perspective of another interviewer, Kirsty Young.
I think that's the sign of a truly standout broadcaster.
Kirsty Young remembers In the Psychiatrist's Chair.
For me, Anthony Clare's programmes remain the high watermark of one-to-one encounters.
Do you think you are, at times, rude?
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tomorrow night at 8. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Time now for the weather. Let's go over to the BBC Weather Centre and Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thanks again, Nick. Well, it's quite a messy weather picture, really, today and throughout the weekend and into next week as well. General themes, it will be unsettled, some showers at times. And for many of us, it's quite a cloudy start to the day. It's also frost-free for Scotland and for Northern Ireland. Quite a mixed start, cloudy with some bright and some sunny spells. Lots of dry weather here, but more cloud building up throughout the day. Again, I think we'll see some more sunshine by the time we get to the end of the afternoon, developing from the northwest. For southern and eastern areas of Scotland, there could be some showers and it will gradually turn a bit less windy here. Let's move further south for England and Wales. Again, it's a mixture of cloud, mostly out towards the west. Some sunny spells, best towards eastern areas of England and towards the southeast. A bit of early mist here. For Wales and the Midlands, then there are some showers on and off throughout the day, some patchy outbreaks of rain. Elsewhere, it is largely dry. There'll be some more sunshine developing, a lot more sunshine developing actually later on through the afternoon and into the evening. The winds are light and it's warmer here. Top temperatures of 16 to 19 Celsius. Further north, it's cooler.
Elizabeth, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 7th of May. The headlines this morning. Reform UK has gained more than 300 councillors and one council in the first results from local elections in England.
People are turning out and they've turned out to repaint the red wall, the turquoise wall, and just onwards and upwards.
Labour has lost control of seven councils in Wales. Labour sources say they expect to lose power in the Senedd for the first time since devolution 27 years ago.
I think the best thing the Prime Minister could do is address the nation tomorrow and set a timetable for an orderly transition.
The one thing you don't want is a precipitous coup or anything like that. You want the party to have time to take into account all those factors and change it.
All the debates and arguments coming up over the next 2 hours, but there is other news too and other headlines. American and Iranian forces have exchanged fire in the Strait of Hormuz, but President Trump says the ceasefire is still in place. And a third British national has been diagnosed with suspected hantavirus linked to the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak.
And also coming up in the next hour, Sir David Attenborough turns 100 today. Emily Evis tells us about his Glastonbury appearance.
He walked onto the stage and was just met with this incredible amount of love and warmth and respect from a cross-generational crowd who all adored him.
The BBC News, read this morning by Tom Saunders.
Reform UK has made sweeping gains in the first results from yesterday's local elections in England, picking up more than 300 seats so far. In the past hour, Reform has gained its first council, winning Newcastle-under-Lyme in Staffordshire from the Conservatives. Labour has lost control of 8 local authorities, including Tamworth, Exeter and Wandsworth. The Tories have picked up Westminster, but have lost more than 100 councillors across England. The Liberal Democrats and the Greens have made modest gains. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports.
This is just an early, partial, English-only picture, but it is one making extremely bleak viewing for the Labour Party. Less than 2 years after winning a landslide majority at Westminster, the party is losing votes almost everywhere. The majority of the council seats Labour went into the night defending have gone. The only thing stopping the list of councils where Labour has lost control from being longer is that in some of them, not all of the seats were up for grabs, so it was not possible for Labour to lose its majorities. The main beneficiary has been Reform UK, which has had an excellent night. At this stage, its vote share is well ahead of any other party's. Reform has also made important gains at the expense of the Conservatives, in yet another sign that the traditional Labour-Conservative duopoly is more fragile than ever. The Liberal Democrats have gained majority control of Stockport and Portsmouth, but lost control of Hull, where Reform surged. The Greens have gained votes in many areas, though that has not translated into significant increases in councillors, albeit with their main targets yet to come. What may prove particularly painful psychologically for Labour is that some of the areas where it has done worst are areas represented in Westminster by its most prominent figures. In Tameside in Greater Manchester, the patch of the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner, Labour was defending 17 seats and lost 16 of them, all to Reform, meaning the party lost overall control. In Wigan, where the MP is the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy, Labour lost all 22 seats it was defending to Reform.
Across England, there are still more than 3,000 seats to declare. Average turnout so far is 43%, up 8 percentage points on 2022, when the same seats were last contested. Our political correspondent Harry Farley has been looking at how the parties have reacted to the results so far.
MPs on the left of the Labour Party are publicly putting the blame for their party's struggles at the door of number 10. The former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, told the BBC voters had a personal animosity to Keir Starmer. In private, many more Labour MPs and ministers believe the Prime Minister can no longer lead the party into the next election. But the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, said changing leader would be the wrong response.
You don't change the pilot during the flight. You carry on and you recognise too that governments sometimes, particularly incumbent governments, have it hard. Look, in Australia, they were behind 10 points. They went on to win.
Reform UK has continued its rise and it is the main winner so far. Its deputy leader is Richard Tice.
Results all over the country are a complete rejection of the two main parties, a complete rejection of the smearing, the sneering, the libelling of Reform and the key people within it, and an endorsement of the success of the councils that we've been running.
The Conservatives claim there are early signs of a recovery, but they continue to lose seats and councils to Reform UK. The Liberal Democrats hail their wins in Stockport and Sutton as stonking results, but elsewhere the picture has been more mixed. For the Greens, results from most of their target areas will come later as counting continues throughout the day.
Counting for the elections for the Scottish Parliament and the Senedd will begin this morning. Multiple Labour sources in Wales say they expect the party to lose power in the Senedd for the first time since devolution in 1999. Here's our Wales correspondent, Hal Griffith.
After a campaign where Welsh Labour consistently trailed in third place in the polls, senior party figures now seem resigned to defeat. The Deputy First Minister, Hugh Waranka-Davies, said it had been a tough election for his party with a mood for change, while another former Welsh minister told the BBC Sir Keir Starmer should stand down if the results were as bad as predicted. All this before a single vote has been counted in the 16 newly formed constituencies, which will return six members each to the Senedd. Plaid Cymru and Reform led the way in the polls throughout the campaign, but neither is expected to win an overall majority. The first results are due at around lunchtime, but it may be several hours or even days before we know who will govern Wales, with every likelihood of collaboration or coalition negotiations stretching into the weekend.
With his thoughts on the results so far, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
First things first, it's worth emphasising this morning's headlines are only an emerging picture and relate only to parts of England. But that emerging picture points to clear trends, not least substantial progress for Reform and Labour going backwards big time. Both these things were expected, but from the government's perspective, think of it like this. It's one thing to imagine root canal surgery at the dentist, another to actually sit in the chair and have it done, which is what sizeable chunks of the electorate appear to be inflicting on Labour today. It's likely we'll hear from the Prime Minister this morning, attempting to shore up his vulnerable position. The key question for his party in the coming hours and days, to which there is no clear answer as yet, is are wounding defeats a stimulus for gloom and a desire for a change of leadership, or gloom and a collective judgment, now is not the time? Ousting a Prime Minister is, of course, a colossal step, but this is a government confronting towering unpopularity and trying to work out how to respond.
In other news, the United States and Iran have exchanged fire in the Strait of Hormuz. Despite the attacks, President Trump has insisted the ceasefire between the two countries remains in place. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The US and Iran each accused the other of firing first in a further outbreak of fighting, which once again endangers the four-week-old ceasefire. The Pentagon said US warships in the Strait of Hormuz came under attack from Iranian missiles, drones and fast boats. The US said it retaliated with strikes on Iranian launches and command sites. The Revolutionary Guard Navy, however, accused the US of violating the truce first with what it called aggression against an Iranian oil tanker and another vessel. American officials are at pains to say the flare-up is not a resumption of the war. But despite Mr. Trump's current apparent preference for dialogue, each of these episodes further erodes the very tenuous peace while Washington and Tehran apply their dueling blockades in the hope of getting better terms in the talks.
A third British national has been diagnosed with suspected hantavirus linked to the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak. The patient is now on a remote South Atlantic island. The vessel, MV Hondius, is due to reach Tenerife in the next few days. Three people who were on board have died. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A British man is in a stable condition in the Netherlands after being evacuated from the ship on Wednesday. Previously, a British passenger was evacuated to South Africa, where he remains in intensive care. Now the UK government has announced that a third British national has suspected hantavirus. That person is on the South Atlantic island of Tristan da Cunha. Four other Britons who left the cruise early are on the island of St Helena. They don't have symptoms. It's understood that medical staff will be sent to the islands to provide support.
A special concert will be held at the Royal Albert Hall tonight to mark Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday today. The event will feature music from his programmes as well as stories and reflections from public figures. It'll be shown live on BBC One at 8:30. Sir David said he'd been completely overwhelmed by the cards and messages he'd received.
Thank you for that. 7:09 is the time. What are we to make of the results of the local elections in England so far? Remember, Scotland and Wales not counted until later today. Professor Sir John Curtis, talking of broadcasting icons, has been in the studio off and on during the course of the night and is here again for us this morning. John, your thoughts?
Well, point number one is it's clear that Reform have performed best in the overnight declarations. They're clearly first ahead in terms of votes. Indeed, running at around, typically around just below 30% or so in the on average in the wards where we've been collecting the detailed results, which is not dissimilar to the performance in the local elections last year. Now, we should remember that's not a very large number. And the second key nut point to make is that our fractured politics are indeed very well and truly with us, because behind Reform are four parties that all of them are somewhere between 15 and 20% or so of the vote on average. Very difficult to distinguish between them. But of course, that means that Reform do have a lead. And under our electoral system, having a lead tends to get turned into seats, and Reform are picking up about one in three of the seats. So this point that therefore also follows from all of this is that the challenge, not just to Labour, but also to the Conservatives under current circumstances, has again been reinforced. The duopolistic dominance of British politics is clearly being challenged. Labour's vote down on average by about 17 points from 4 years ago, the Conservatives by about 12 points. But of course, these were elections which were held predominantly in Labour territory, and mostly the seats that were last contested at a time when Labour were ahead in the polls. So inevitably, Labour had more to lose, and Labour are losing around a half of the seats they're trying to defend, which suggests they're going to end up, if this carries on, with about 1,200, 1,300 losses. The Conservatives are losing about one in three of the seats that they're trying to defend. So I think, you know, much does now depend on what happens today as to whether or not the losses do extend to the 1,500 that some people have said might set the panic button going inside Labour MPs, or whether indeed it may not be nothing quite so high as that.
On the Labour reform battle, is it clear whether Labour are losing because Labour people are going straight to reform,
no,
or because Labour people are going elsewhere.
No,
that
it's
matters,
not.
Doesn't
no,
it,
it's
for
not.
That
the,
debate?
The opinion polls tell us that while Labour are losing some ground to reform, they're losing more support to the Greens. And what you discover, if you look at the pattern, the results, where the Greens, if you compare the impact on Labour of where the Greens do particularly well and where reform do particularly well, a good Green performance is more damaging to Labour than a good reform performance. So that doesn't mean to say that reform aren't taking some votes from Labour, but the point is that is consistent with the Greens being more likely to take votes off Labour. And we have to remember that Labour's problem is that even the reason they can lose seats to reform is not simply because they themselves are losing seats to reform, but yes, they're losing some. They're also losing more to the Greens. And meanwhile, the reform are taking votes off the Tories. Net effect, reform pick up a lot of seats from Labour. And that does underline the fact that A, Labour have this problem that their coalition is fracturing in two directions, but B, also, the problem of reform is not the solution is not entirely in their hands, because frankly, if reform are going to go down in the polls, it needs something of a conservative recovery. Not that the Labour Party would ever admit it.
Yeah, and of course there is also a debate. There's an obvious debate in Labour, and it matters hugely because it involves the Prime Minister. But there is also a debate in the Conservatives, isn't there? And you can see it over the night. Gavin Barwell and others on the left of the party, as it were, saying, "Look, we got to fight for the kind of votes that we might be able to get from the Lib Dems, from Labour, actually, as well. And we've got to leave reform to do their thing."
Well, indeed. I mean, and one of the things to note, again, the opinion polls are now telling us, is that, and this perhaps is now quite staggering, the party that delivered Brexit is no longer more popular amongst the people who voted for it than it is amongst those who voted against it. The coalition of Leave voters that took Boris Johnson to electoral success in 2019 has been taken from them by reform. And it does mean that the Conservatives have a choice now. Do they try now to reconnect with the many Remain voters they lost during the Brexit years on the grounds that they now really cannot compete with reform? Or do they try to compete directly with reform in order to try to get them back? So again, as in the case of Labour, the electoral options, the strategic situation that the Conservatives face is not a straightforward one.
OK, and we'll put some of those points to Sir James Cleverly, who we're going to be talking to over the course of the next hour or so. For the time being, though, Sir John, thank you.
And we're hoping to hear from Nigel Farage in a few minutes' time as well. But for now, it is 7:15.
And there has been another case announced of hantavirus. It's another British patient currently on the South Atlantic island of Tristan da Cunha. Let us talk to Peter Holby, who's former chair of the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, now director of the Pandemic Sciences Institute at the University of Oxford. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make, first of all, of the efforts so far that there have been to prevent the further spread of the virus?
The authorities are doing exactly what they need to do, really. The important measures are, you know, identify new cases and give them appropriate medical care and make sure they don't infect other people, and then to trace all of their high-risk contacts, which seems to be quite an endeavour at the moment, given what we've heard about patients, or people leaving the boat and travelling to multiple countries. But the international coordination seems to be going well, and hopefully all those contacts will be traced and monitored until they're out of the potential incubation period.
And these are contacts, of course, of people who show symptoms. Are we clear yet? Do we know yet whether you can transmit it asymptomatically? In other words, you don't know you've got it.
There have been no reported cases of this virus being transmitted from asymptomatic people, but we know it can be transmitted in the early stages of illness when you're just sort of feeling a bit unwell with fever, etc. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. You know, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, so to speak. So we don't know for sure, but there's no evidence of it.
Is there anything that you think governments ought to be doing, including our own, in preparation that they're not? I mean, other than the normal things that governments would do, and they'll all say that they're monitoring, et cetera, and working with the WHO. Is there something that isn't happening that you would hope would?
In the short term, no. I think everyone is doing exactly what they need to do. This virus is behaving as we know it can behave, and there's nothing particularly unusual, although it is a difficult context of the boat and the distances, etc. But in the long term, you know, we don't have any vaccines for this particular virus. We don't have any treatments for it. And there needs to be investment in that so that if we see, you know, more transmission of this type of virus, we have the tools we need to prevent disease and transmission.
Do you think there will be now as a result of this? Because it has been a worldwide scare, in a sense. Certainly, it's certainly been reported around the world in a way that this virus hasn't been really touched before, although, of course, it's been in existence.
Yeah, there's a whole raft of these viruses out there, and we know about them, and we know we have the tools to make the diagnostics, drugs and vaccines for them. We just need the investment and the effort to make that happen.
Well, look, for the time being, Peter Horby, a former chair of the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, thank you very much. And we will bring you further news as we get it during the course of the morning. But just to say, there is one other British national now who's been suspected of contracting hantavirus, and that person is currently on the island of Tristan da Cunha.
It's now 18 minutes past seven. This week on the programme, we've been celebrating the life of Sir David Attenborough, who is 100 years old today. We've been hearing reflections from well-known friends and fans of his work. Here's Emily Evis, the organiser of the Glastonbury Festival, who invited Sir David to speak at Glastonbury in 2019.
So it was always a dream of mine to have David Attenborough to visit Glastonbury Festival. So when he agreed to performing or speaking on the Pyramid Stage, it was probably one of the highlights of my entire life to get him here, and to see him walk out in front of that enormous crowd was so incredible.
Thank you. Those extraordinary, marvellous sounds that you've just been listening to are the... were the songs from the creatures that live in the sea, in the great oceans.
We're used to dealing with lots of complex rider requests from bands, you know. We always ask everybody performing what they would like in their dressing room when they arrive. And the only thing that David Attenborough requested was a cheese sandwich, which is very easy for us to provide with our worthy farm cheddar. So we made him a cheese sandwich. And it was just so lovely that he came, and all he requested was such a simple thing to produce. And he walked onto the stage and was just met with this incredible amount of love and warmth and respect from a cross-generational crowd who all adored him. So we are so thankful that he came, and we're so thankful to David Attenborough for just being an incredible leader and champion for all the natural world and the environment and planet Earth and all of humankind.
That was Emily Evis talking about Sir David Attenborough. We'll be hearing from Sir Michael Palin later in the programme.
It is now 20 past seven. It has been a difficult night, a grim night for the Labour Party, a night when already the party has begun to debate what should they do now. Is it time to talk about the leadership, a possible change from Sir Keir Starmer? Is it time to talk about new policy, or is it simply about presenting what the party does better? Here is a glimpse of some of the reactions that we had overnight as the results came in.
It's bad. It's a really soul-destroying night. We've lost a large number of really good Labour councillors.
It's also around, yes, the leadership. And that isn't just Keir Starmer, it's the leadership collectively as well, because it's the Cabinet have made these decisions that I think have been horrendous mistakes.
I think it's time for leadership change at the top, I'm afraid. I wish Keir Starmer no ill, but I think ultimately he's not the right man for the job.
That was the Labour Group leader in Hull, Darren Hale, and before that, the former Shadow Chancellor, an ally of Jeremy Corbyn's, John McDonnell, and Rebecca Long-Bailey, another member of the Corbyn team, all critical of Keir Starmer. Let's join now the Mayor of the West Midlands, Richard Parker. Good morning to you, Mr. Parker.
Good morning, Nick.
I know there's a lot of results still to come in, not least in the great city of Birmingham, but things do not look good for your party, do they?
No, you don't. Look, it's been a really difficult, painful night. And given the national position, I'm expecting us to lose some very good councils, very good council leaders across the West Midlands. during the course of today. And that's really important to me because I need serious people working with me to grow and develop and create jobs and opportunity in this region. And today I've been supported by 4 Labour council leaders and 3 Conservative council leaders on my board. They've all taken their role seriously. They supported me on the big decisions we needed to make. And frankly, I'm not sure what reforms stand for locally or what they're serious about. And I do need serious people working with me. We need serious people running our councils if we're going to make the serious decisions we need to make to rebuild our economy here in the West Midlands and make the difference that I want and everyone wants this region to make.
Just to be clear, Mr. Parker, I mean, of course, you're no fan of reform. You'd be in their party if you were. But you're making, I think, a deeper point, are you, that the nature of politics now in local councils could make it hard to make the sort of progress that you're determined to make?
No, absolutely. There's serious work to be done at a council level in terms of children's services, adult social care, supporting business investment and growth, and being an advocate for this place in this region to help attract investment. That's what I do every day. And I have 7 council leaders on my board. The decisions I want to make in the interest of the region need the backing of my board. So I need serious people that are serious about this region.
Why has it been so bad for the party? Clearly, there were specific issues in Birmingham itself. That bin strike's gone on for such a long time, and the signs are pretty grim for the Labour Party in Birmingham once we get all of those seats counted, aren't they?
Well, look, Birmingham's been turned around by the current leader, John Cotton. It's now balanced its budgets. It's got a really good settlement from government.
People remember that terrible bin strike, won't they?
I know. We've made real progress on the bin strikes, and I work really closely on that with the council leader and with Sharon Graham from Unite to get that in a very good place in advance of the election. But also, to the credit of the Labour regime in Birmingham, we've attracted investment. We've got a sports quarter. American investors investing $3 billion in the city, and with the support of government, we've put £2.5 billion into transport, and we're creating the largest Merrill Development Corporation in the country, a £10 billion.
It all sounds jolly good. It's just a shame that nobody wants to vote for it. Is the problem, isn't it, Mr. Barker?
I think what I'm saying, Nick, is, you know, I've just outlined why I need serious people to work with on this investment.
And forgive me, you made that point a couple of times, which is why I'm interrupting you. I just want to give you the chance. If Keir Starmer were to pick up the phone now to you and say, look, some people are telling me I should go. Other people are saying I should set out a timetable which would allow a leadership contest to take place in a civilised way over a few months. Others are saying fight on. What would your advice be?
Look, I'm a serious politician. The Prime Minister is too. We need to reflect on the results. That will take a bit of time. But we do need a serious, meaningful, material reset. We need to ensure that the great work we're doing has a real resonance and is really tangible and making a real tangible difference to people in our communities.
Translate reset, would you? Because I'm not sure people listening will know quite what you mean by that. What do you mean by reset?
Well, look, I visited communities that feel hollowed out. They suffered from the years of austerity under the Conservatives, have never recovered from deindustrialisation. They feel overlooked and left behind. We need to ensure that what we're doing, our policies, are making a real difference on the ground in those communities. We're revitalising our high streets, making people feel safe for investing in policing, and ensuring that we're giving particularly our young people, supporting the work I'm doing on skills, the opportunities to get access to skills that will give them well-paid work for the rest of their lives. So those are the things I'm working on. If we can continue to work with government nationally to deliver on the ground, making a difference to people's lives, Labour can be in a far better place, a place to win the next general election
even under Keir Starmer's leadership.
Indeed, I think there is a need for a reset and a refocus. And if we do that, I'm confident we can respond in a really positive and constructive way to the results that we've seen overnight.
Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, Labour Mayor of West Midlands, thank you for joining us.
James Cleverly and Nigel Farage coming up in the next half hour, and John Healy coming up for Labour for the government after 8 o'clock. But at 27 minutes past 7, Mike and the Sport.
Justin, thank you. Aston Villa are through to a first European final for 44 years. They swept aside Nottingham Forest 4-0 last night in their Europa League semi-final second leg. Meant they won the tie 4-1 on aggregate, and they will now play the German side Freiburg in the final in Istanbul a week on Wednesday. That is the 20th of May. We'll have more reflections on that achievement in the next hour of the programme. Alongside Aston Villa and Arsenal, who of course made the final of the Champions League earlier this week, there will be another English club in a major European final this season.
The Crystal Palace fans celebrate! Book those flights! Book those hotels! Tell word to get lost! Because Palace are going to Leipzig!
They certainly are. Crystal Palace are through to the Europa Conference League final in Leipzig. They beat Shakhtar Donetsk last night 2-1 at Selhurst Park to win their semi-final 5-2 on aggregate. Well, you heard BBC London commentator Nick Godwin just then, and he's with us now. Hi, Nick.
Good morning.
So just put this into context for us. These really are halcyon days, aren't they, for Crystal Palace and their supporters. They are through to a first ever European final in their 120-year history.
Yes, it's been an astonishing couple of seasons, really, for Crystal Palace. If you think, until 12 months ago, they'd never really won anything. They've now won the FA Cup. They've gone back to Wembley and won the Community Shield. And now they're going to have the chance to contest a major European final in their first ever European adventure. So it's the whole thing, I think, for Crystal Palace fans is nothing short of breathtaking.
And in a season and a competition, the Conference League, the Crystal Palace weren't actually meant to be playing in originally.
No, they got kicked out of the Europa League, and so there's been this huge sense of injustice and anger in some quarters, certainly. But perhaps the great irony is that if they get the job done in Leipzig against Rayo Vallecano, they will qualify for the Europa League, a rather unconventional way of getting into that competition. But that's the really big prize, perhaps, if they manage to succeed in Leipzig.
And that final in Leipzig will be manager Oliver Glasner's final match in charge. He announced earlier this year that he will be leaving in the summer. I mean, he, even in just a few short years, Nick, has surely installed himself as one of Crystal Palace's greatest ever managers.
Well, I think if you're looking at the sheer amount of success, he is beyond doubt the most successful manager they've had. I mean, they've got to FA Cup finals, they've had great teams. But if you think of just purely on the days out, on the excitement that he's generated for Crystal Palace supporters, and that the days that they will all remember for the rest of their lives, I personally think Oliver Glasner stands alone.
Just very briefly, Nick, got to be favourites, haven't they, against the Spanish side, Rayo Vallecano, in that final in Leipzig in a couple of weeks?
I think so, yes. They've been pretty much favourites for most of this competition so far. But Oliver Glasner, were he here, would be warning very much against complacency. That's been his watchword. They will do the same professional job they've done all the way through this tournament. But yes, a lot of Crystal Palace fans, I think, are waking up this morning thinking there is a chance for another piece of silverware just 12 months after their very first.
Exciting times. Nick Godwin, many thanks for that this morning. So a very exciting few weeks await for the fans of Arsenal, Aston Villa and Crystal Palace. The first time ever that three English clubs have reached the final of all three major European competitions.
It's going to be quite a few weeks watching those finals. It's going to be rather special. Mike, thank you.
Drama on Radio 4.
Something's wrong.
It's the new AI model. It's gone rogue and it's trying to kill us.
Imagine artificial intelligence becoming too intelligent and taking control.
It spreads by hacking into systems and installing copies of itself called sub-agents.
It's hit transport signalling. There's been a train crash at Waterloo.
A thrilling radio drama based on the latest research in AI safety.
It's like the computer equivalent of Chernobyl.
Wraith starts this afternoon at 2:15. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
To the weather. Areas of cloud and showers for many today. Drier though, clear spells tonight.
Coming up in the next half hour, we're going to be hearing from the Conservatives, from Reform UK. We'll be talking about the latest in the war with Iran as well.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb. It is 29 minutes to 8. Let us have a summary of the news from Tom Sanders.
Reform UK has made significant gains in the first results from the local elections in England, picking up more than 350 seats and winning its first council of the elections, Newcastle-under-Lyme in Staffordshire, from the Conservatives. Labour has suffered substantial losses, failing to hold on to more than half of the seats the party was trying to defend. Almost 250 Labour councillors have lost their seats so far. There's still a long way to go, with close to 100 councils declaring later today and a handful due tomorrow. Labour has held on to 10 councils, but it's lost control of 8, including Hartlepool, where Reform won all the seats being contested. Labour also lost Westminster to the Conservatives, who've regained control of the council, though they lost at the previous election. In total, the Tories lost more than 130 seats overnight. The Liberal Democrats have made some gains, winning Stockport and Portsmouth, but losing Hull. The Greens have also picked up some seats, with results for their main target areas coming later today. Counting in the Scottish Parliament and Welsh Senedd elections won't begin until later this morning, but Labour sources have told the BBC they expect to have lost the vote in Wales for the first time since devolution 27 years ago. In other news, President Trump has said a ceasefire with Iran is still in place despite a clash between Iran and US warships in the Strait of Hormuz last night. Washington and Tehran have blamed each other for the exchange of fire. A third British national has suspected hantavirus linked to the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak. The patient is now on a remote South Atlantic island. The ship, the MV Hondius, is due to reach Tenerife by Sunday. And Sir David Attenborough turns 100 today, a celebration concert at the Royal Albert Hall featuring music from his programmes. We broadcast live on BBC One this evening.
Thank you for that, Tom. It is 27 minutes to 8. What do the Conservatives make of the results so far of the English council election? Scotland and Wales, of course, not yet counting. Let us talk to Sir James Cleverly, the Shadow Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government, who is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
There is a right-wing challenger, isn't there, to this unpopular government, but it is not you.
Well, there are a number of challenges to this unpopular Labour government. Reform is one of them. I'm assuming that's the party you're referring to. That is one of them. But actually what we see in Parliament, for example, is there really is only one party at all holding the government to account, and that's Kemi Badenoch.
But not in the nation.
That's the Conservative Party.
When people have wanted to oppose this government and have decided to vote for a right-wing party, in this set of elections, they have not turned to the Conservatives, have they?
Well, I don't agree with you. It's a mixed picture. Look, you're right to highlight that Reform have done well, and that is self-evidently clear, but it is a mixed picture. We've just heard that we've taken control of Westminster Council. It looks like we're going to form the administration in Wandsworth Council.
You had control of back in the day, didn't you?
And we've now got it back again. So this is the point that whether it's Fareham Council on the south coast, Harlow in Essex, Peterborough. So look, there are areas where we have done less well than we would have liked, and there are areas where we have done better than people expected. The point is that we know that we are on. Still, that path to regain the full trust of the British voters. We recognise that. This is less than 2 years since a historic defeat for us. And we've got to be realistic about that. But the fact is that we've still got a really, really strong campaigning machine. We've got fantastic people right across the country. And in Kemi, we've got a leader who has set out a very clear vision of how we are going to serve the British people.
It's the right across the country thing that I think might worry some Conservative supporters, because they look at Reform and the kind of, you've pointed to one or two places where you have done well. Mm-hmm. And you have, mm-hmm. And I'm not denying that, but you look at Reform and they have done well in such a range of places, in Wigan, in a London council, in Havering, in all manner of parts of the country, and they're going to do well, aren't they, in Wales and in Scotland too, relatively. And that is your problem, isn't it, that you are not punching through in the UK as a whole?
Well, they are making promises that they know they cannot deliver. And those promises are, in the short term at least, very appealing to voters. But what we have seen in the last 12 months, since they've taken control of a number of councils, is they've spectacularly failed to deliver on their promises. So they've lost 70 councillors since this time last year when they had the previous set of local government elections. In Worcestershire, for example, putting council tax up by 9%, the biggest council tax increase in the country. The UK Doge that was going to fire all these diversity and inclusion officers and save millions and millions of pounds, none of that has happened.
And yet people still vote for them.
Well, no, the people that voted for them last year who are actually experiencing their ineptitude in government, that's not the people who are voting this time round. And the point being, ultimately, we recognise that if you're just going to make undeliverable promises, you can harvest some short-term popularity. And we're seeing that from the Greens, we're seeing that from Reform. What we are doing is the much more professional and arguably slower job of work, which is to only promise things that we can deliver, because we know that we need to regain the trust of an increasingly cynical set of voters. And that is what Kemi is focused on.
So on that, what do you make of what Gavin Barwell, Lord Barwell, has been saying overnight? He was saying it to Nick on his overnight election programme, making the point that, in effect, that the party needs to be not fighting Reform on Reform's territory, but actually fighting for Lib Dem votes, fighting even for Labour votes, turning to a broader centre constituency, which he, Lord Barwell, and of course very much part of the previous Conservative setup, he's a peer now, but he thinks the party does have a way now of appealing to people in the centre ground that is its way to go, that should be the strategy. And he's not critical of Kemi Badenoch as a leader, much the opposite, but he's saying there needs to be a strategy added to her leadership.
Well, we have got a strategy.
Well, is that the right one, though, the Barwell strategy?
Well, no, because Gavin, who is a very, very long-standing friend, is not leader of the Conservative Party. And look, we listen to voices, but ultimately the person that sets the agenda is Kemi.
But is he wrong? I mean, that's the point.
Hang on, I was about to come on to this. So I think he's made a category error in how he's looking at it. It's not about chasing the voters of particular parties. What it is about is us as Conservatives setting out our agenda, not trying to copy other political parties. We are certainly not copying anyone. We're definitely not copying Reform. What we're doing is we're setting out our plans to bring down taxes because we know they're too high, to secure our borders because we know that is an issue of massive concern, to put more police on the streets, to get our high streets going again, to get lower energy for both businesses and consumers. Now, that's not about chasing votes in just for electoral purposes.
But it's about stressing things that will appeal to certain groups of people, I suppose. That's the point.
Well, it is about putting forward an agenda which is genuinely about aspiration. It's about securing our economic independence, defending our nation. And that should be, and I think will be, appealing to a very wide range of people. And it's not about trying to chase after Lib Dem voters or chase after Reform voters or chase after Labour voters. It's about putting forward a consistent and deliverable Conservative agenda, which I very, very, very much believe will be broadly popular. And it's not about centre ground or left or right. It is about doing Conservative things, getting the important things right, and being credible. And this is the big difference between us and parties like Reform or the Greens, who are getting short-term popularity by promising things that they believe to be popular, not that they believe to be right. Which is why Reform, for example, tie themselves up in knots over welfare spending, because they haven't actually got an idea of what they're seeking to achieve.
Except, of course, popularity is what wins you elections. That's the challenge for you, isn't it?
Well, look, if it's just about winning elections, this is what we see with the Labour Party. Keir Starmer said his greatest achievement was walking through the doors of Downing Street. And again, Farage keeps talking about how he wants to kill off the Tories, how he wants to upset the apple cart. He's not actually talking about what he's going to do for the British people. And that fundamentally is the difference. If you think winning the election is the end of the process, you are doing it wrong. It is the thing that enables you to govern in the national interest. We recognise that. Kemi recognises that. The other leaders of political parties, including Keir Starmer, sadly, seem not to understand that.
Sir James Cleverley, thank you very much for talking to us.
Cheers, thank you, Justin.
It is now 19 minutes past eight. Nigel Farage, I think, has gone celebrating. We haven't quite managed to track him down.
What, before we get to him, then, if indeed we are going to get to him, what do you make of what Sir James has just been saying? And indeed what Gavin Barwell was saying, I think, to you in the programme overnight, which I thought in the dim recesses of the night while I was listening to you, was actually fascinating, because that, in a sense, it mirrors the Labour debate, doesn't it? Do we go left? Do we go right? What do we do?
Exactly. There's a pretty strong argument amongst many Conservatives that there is no point in aping reform. Because, to put it crudely, if people want a more Brexity, more anti-immigration, more anti-woke, more anti-net zero party, well, they'll go with Nigel Farage, because he's believed all of those things for a very long time. And the argument goes, indeed, there's a political movement called Prosper, set up by the former mayor of the West Midlands, the Conservative Andy Street, Sir Andy, that they should reach out to people in the centre of British politics and try to get hold of them. But just as Keir Starmer finds it very difficult to find a policy that keeps both wings of his party happy, Kemi Badenoch is finding it extraordinarily difficult to keep both wings of her party happy. There's a bigger problem, though, Justin, which I think sometimes people forget on mornings like this. Councillors are often the foot soldiers for political parties. And when you lose hundreds, and cumulatively in the Conservative case, thousands of councillors, and not just them, you lose their wives and husbands and sons and daughters, their friends who come out and canvass for them, you are losing the people who come out on doorsteps and make the difference when it comes to winning a general election. There are some areas of the country now in which there are more Conservative MPs than there are Conservative councillors. That's how badly they've done in certain areas. And reform will also be able to say, it looks like at the end of all these election results, look, we reform are winning in areas the Conservatives can't get near to. Those Lancashire mill towns, for example, or as we're going to see later when the votes are counted in Scotland and Wales, where it looks like reform will come second in Wales and may come second or third in Scotland. It is pretty tricky for the Conservatives. But our minds this morning are bound to be more on the plight of the Prime Minister, who I suspect we're going to hear from in the next hour or so, and indeed of the Labour Party itself. And as we mentioned just when we came on air this morning, Justin, there was a fascinating moment on our overnight election coverage in which the Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy came into this studio and found John McDonnell there, Shadow Chancellor under Jeremy Corbyn. Two men with very, very different views about the Labour Party. And you get these moments on election nights where the sort of private conversations you often would like to hear, you do get to hear, because they're in front of a microphone together, agonising about what election results mean for them and their party. So here is a little bit of that conversation between David Lammy and John McDonnell.
This is a tough set of elections. It's definitely a midterm set of elections. And there's a phenomenon. And in a sense, it's a new phenomenon, because we are seeing a much greater fragmentation, much more volatility in the electorate. And in a sense, whilst I remember, and John will remember this, back after the Iraq war, we were losing in London to the Liberal Democrats in some areas. This time, because of reform, you're being squeezed on both sides. Mm.
You're sitting next to John McDonnell, who's just made the argument, you won't be surprised by it, saying the party's got to reflect. No coup, he says, no rush into a change of leadership, but leadership has to be part of the agenda of considering what happens next. That's just rational, isn't it, that leadership should be part of the conversation about what happens next?
No, you don't change the pilot during the flight. You carry on, and you recognise too that governments sometimes, particularly incumbent governments, have it hard. But yes, of course we reflect on what we're hearing from the electorate. There's a lot of frustration. Sometimes our mistakes have been heard more than our achievements. And so we do have to reflect. We have to be bold. We have to be firm, strong, and we have to pick up pace.
But John McDonnell, he says, don't change the pilot midway through the flight.
I wish you hadn't used that analogy of the pilot, to be honest. Sometimes you do if you're in a nosedive. What I'm advocating is a serious consideration of all the factors that have led us to what is a nightmare tonight. And you can't get away from listing those factors. It is around policy, it's around communication, it's also around Yes, the leadership. And that isn't just Keir Starmer, it's the leadership collectively as well, because it's the Cabinet have made these decisions that I think have been horrendous mistakes. However, the one thing you don't want is a precipitous coup or anything like that. You want the party to have time to take into account all those factors and change it.
Look, I don't know if John and I are going to agree entirely. What I saw under John's leadership of the party was we piled on votes in urban areas and simply couldn't take the country. So I think we all recognise. My own view is that when Labour's in power, and I'm interested in being in power, not just opposing, exactly, we are a broad coalition. The timetable's 40 months till the next election. That's the timetable, and that's the timetable we should stick to. The British people will determine who's in number 10. And I hope that they will give us another go and we'll get the decade that we need to change this country for the better. But yes, we'll have to pick up pace. Yes, we'll have to communicate. And of course, we'll reflect.
That was David Lammy and John McDonnell in the Election Night studio here. Incidentally, we know where Nigel Farage is now. He's heading to a Reform UK victory, to Havering, to speak to all the cameras and all the microphones. We may hear a little bit of that. We may get a chance to have a conversation with Mr. Farage once he's done with that.
Time now, 13 minutes to 8. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Jane Manfredi, who is a writer and Anglican deacon.
Good morning. If you live to be 100, will you still be the same person inside who you've always been? Will the same things still make you laugh? Will you remember the best moments of your life and the worst? Will you still care about the world, and will it still care about you if you live to be 100? Let's ask Sir David Attenborough, who today reaches 100. He's helped create some of the most beloved and respected nature programmes ever made, but he's a mere whippersnapper in comparison with some of the antediluvian patriarchs from the Book of Genesis. There is Methuselah, of course, who is listed as living 969 years. He appears in the genealogy from Adam to Noah, who only lived for 950 years. After the flood, the patriarchs got younger. Moses, for example, only lived for a mere 120 years. There are symbolic and literary interpretations for why these men were described as being extraordinarily long-lived. These stories tell us that ageing should not be feared, but revered. That the older a person was, the more respected they were, the more important they were, and crucially, the closer they were to God. Today, ageing is more feared than ever before. We have an obsession with artificially preserving youth to an unnatural degree, as if ageing were a shameful secret. The middle-aged are spoken of with a hint of derision, our parents dismissed as privileged, clueless boomers, and the generation before them, silent. Of course, old age doesn't always lead to wisdom, but anti-ageing rhetoric, however subtle, does lead to a disquieting erosion of worth. To see the elderly as God sees them would be to regard ageing as a privilege, and to see those older than us as repositories of wisdom and experience instead of a burden on public resources. It is the elderly who engage most in public service, making up an army of volunteers who do everything from maintaining communal outdoor space, helping run various social groups, and caring for grandchildren. They are the custodians of the Christian faith, valued elders who play a vital role in the life of the church. Psalm 92 speaks of cedars planted in the house of the Lord, how in old age they're still green and produce fruit. In every community, there are to be found inspiring archetypes of ageing. We place all our hopes in the young, for they represent the future, but our elders don't just belong to the past, they are the present too. They still have the ability to take the world by surprise. Happy 100th birthday, Sir David. If I live to be 100, may I too be green and full of fruit.
That was Thought for the Day. We don't often comment on it, but I think we could all say happy birthday, Sir David. That was Thought for the Day with Jane Manfredi.
We've had news overnight of two apparent breaches of the Iran-US ceasefire. So an exchange of fire after the US says its ships were attacked near the Strait of Hormuz, and a missile attack
by Iran on the United Arab Emirates, according to that nation. Donald Trump put it all like this: they trifled with us today, we blew them away. I've been talking to David Satterfield, Special Envoy for Middle East Humanitarian Issues during the Biden administration, and we started by whether this could be rightly described as simply a flare-up or whether it is potentially something more serious.
We don't know. Whether it is a flare-up, a skirmish, a love tap, as the president described it, or something more serious, I think we have to appreciate the context. The U.S. and Iran, through Pakistan, was engaged in, is still engaged in, presumably, a complex negotiation. And in the midst of all of that comes Operation Freedom. And whatever the intent, the fact is it was seen as an escalation by Iran.
To what extent do you think Iran is in charge, then, of this situation and potentially of these negotiations, if indeed there are negotiations?
Iran is indeed in the dominant position. It has demonstrated the ability to close the strait and keep the strait closed for a very long period of time. Every analysis indicates that Iran's capacity to wait out the U.S., to wait out the world in terms of endurance, is quite long.
What do you think a reasonable red line could be, then, that the U.S. does go for?
I can certainly say, speaking for the global market, what has to be a red line, which is the strait must reopen. But I think for the president, he will need to demonstrate something on the nuclear issue that he can credibly say is an advance over the JCPOA's term. Now, what that is of course, an Iranian agreement to a complete freeze on all enrichment activities of any kind.
That was David Satterfield talking to me overnight. Let us talk now to Jeremy Byrne, our international editor, who's on the line. What do you make, Jeremy, of where we are now? Because the president is very obviously trying to make light of what happened overnight, and yet it does seem like a pretty serious exchange of fire.
It was undoubtedly serious. Both sides blaming each other for starting it. President Trump, meanwhile, saying to his visitors, for example, President Lula of Brazil, said after their meeting that that in private, Trump said to him, yeah, the war is definitely over, there's no doubt about that. The Pakistanis, the intermediaries, are saying that they're optimistic that something may come out of this. However, it just shows the fragility of the process, the fact that I would say that a big flare-up in the war, bigger than what we've just seen, is only a serious incident away because of the situation there, the fact that there is so much military power there. So where are we at? Well, I think both sides want a deal. The thing is, they don't want the deal that the other one is offering.
David Satterfield making the interesting point, and it's been made before, but emphasising the point that actually the Iranian side can wait this out for much longer than is comfortable for President Trump, or indeed for the world as it looks on and wants the Strait of Hormuz reopened?
Well, resilience and resistance and taking the long view is something that the regime has schooled itself into believing in, and it's something that President Trump, taking the long view and being patient is not one of his great virtues. I think that's absolutely true. Plus, he lives, you know, he has a different system in the United States. There are elections coming towards the end of the year, and he needs something. As David Satterfield was saying, some sort of an agreement on enriching uranium, the big nuclear issue, that is not impossible. Iran was actually offering quite major concessions on that at the time that Israel and America attacked it on the 28th of February. And considering that their facilities are, by all accounts, under quite a lot of rubble at the moment, they need time to rebuild it anyway. I think more difficult, and something that's probably top of their agenda, is that they want their control over the Strait of Hormuz not just to be recognized, but to be institutionalized in some way. And that is clear that they do not want to return to the status quo, and having that chokehold potentially, even if they decide to reopen it, that's something that really changes things, and that's something clearly that they want. And of course, the Americans would hate to have to accept it.
But they've also overnight attacked with drones and missiles the United Arab Emirates. What is happening there? How does that side of all of this fit into the whole?
The UAE have doubled down on their relationship with the United States and more especially Israel. They talk of each other as strategic allies now. And that means that they are very much in Iran's sight. So I think it's also a reminder that if the war full on started again, that the UAE would probably be top of Iran's target list. And I think that the Iranians are saying to the and showing to the Emiratis that you better be careful because we still have a capacity to really hurt you and damage your economy badly.
But is that potentially also an overreach on the side of Iran? In other words, that they now have reined against them, not just the United States and Israel, but potentially at least one of the Gulf states, if not behind the scenes, others as well, and that that for them in the longer term isn't a comfortable place to be.
It's very uncomfortable, and it's also that without question, the Iranians can get have in the past and no doubt in the future will be getting things wrong in terms of assessing the mood of their neighbors, of their enemies. And the threat of overreach, of making a mistake, of pushing, playing their cards. You know, President Trump always likes these cards metaphors. He always says he has all the cards. But Iran has some cards. But the question is how they play them. And if they try and overbid on this, well, they could find themselves in even more of a mess than actually they're in.
Jeremy Byrne, thank you.
It is now 8:03. Alex Forsyth's been up all night, but she's going to be up this evening presenting any questions. Who have you got tonight?
I am indeed, Nick. I'm about to jump on a train and head to Pontia in Torfaen in southeast Wales when we should have a picture of what the election results mean for Wales. And on our panel to discuss that and anything else will be the Secretary of State for Wales, Labour's Joe Stevens, the Shadow Welsh Secretary, Conservative MP Mims Davis, Plaid Cymru's Treasury spokesman Ben Lake, and the political commentator and Reform UK supporter Tim Montgomery. We're live as ever, 8 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Alex, thank you for that. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Elizabeth Rizzini.
Hello, very good morning to you. Excuse me, it's a lot milder today towards the southern half of the UK. It's going to be quite a mixed few days of weather, so there will be some showers around at times. We've now drawn in a southerly wind. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, it's quite a mixed start to the morning. It's cloudy with some sunny spells around. Some showers towards southern and eastern areas of Scotland, though. Further south for England and Wales, it's a mixture of cloud and some brightness, some spells of sunshine. For Wales and the Midlands, we've got plenty of cloud this morning, and we're also likely to see some showers on and off as well, but there will be more sunshine developing later on through the afternoon. The winds are light for most. They'll certainly ease down across Scotland. Temperatures for Scotland and Northern Ireland 10 to 14 degrees Celsius. For Northern England and Wales 13 to 16 degrees, and for the rest of England we're looking at 16 to 19 Celsius, but we might just get to 20 degrees Celsius perhaps in the far south and east. Overnight tonight, two things to note. One of the weather fronts will pop up across Northern England. That's going to bring some cloud and some patchy outbreaks of rain. Another area of low pressure just approaches into southwest England, so cloud and rain here, elsewhere clear skies. And it's going to be cold enough for a touch of frost, I suspect, across parts of eastern Scotland. Tomorrow, more of the same rain across northeast England. Further south, it will be largely dry and warm.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 8th of May. The headlines this morning: Reform UK has gained more than 350 council seats in the first wave of local election results in England.
People are turning out, and they've turned out to repaint the red wall, the turquoise wall, and just onwards and upwards.
Labour has lost control of 8 councils. In Wales, Labour is expected to lose power in the Senedd.
It's bad. It's a really soul-destroying night. We've lost a large number of really good Labour councillors.
I think it's time for leadership change at the top, I'm afraid. I wish Keir Starmer no ill, but I think ultimately he's not the right man for the job.
And two other headlines. President Trump has insisted the US ceasefire with Iran is still in place, despite an exchange of fire last night in the Strait of Hormuz. And a third British national has suspected hantavirus linked to the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak.
Coming up in the next hour, we know that the Prime Minister is preparing to speak. We know that Nigel Farage is preparing to speak. When we can, we will bring them to you. We'll hear from the Defence Secretary, John Healey, about why he thinks Keir Starmer should stay in his job. And
this magnificent creature preparing,
preparing to lay her eggs is the largest of all turtles, a leatherback.
Happy birthday, Sir David Attenborough. 100 years old today. His friend, Sir Michael Palin, will be with us in the studio ahead of a concert to celebrate Sir David's achievements. All that after the BBC News read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
Reform UK has made sweeping gains in the first results from yesterday's local elections in England, picking up more than 350 seats so far. Reform has also gained its first council, winning Newcastle-under-Lyme in Staffordshire from the Conservatives. Labour have lost more than 200 councillors and lost control of 8 local authorities, including Tamworth, Exeter and Wandsworth. The Tories have picked up Westminster but have lost more than 100 councillors across England. Our chief political correspondent Henry Zeffman reports.
This is just an early, partial, English-only picture, but it is one making extremely bleak viewing for the Labour Party. Less than 2 years after winning a landslide majority at Westminster, the party is losing votes almost everywhere. The majority of the council seats Labour went into the night defending have gone. The only thing stopping the list of councils where Labour has lost control from being longer is that in some of them, not all of the seats were up for grabs, so it was not possible for Labour to lose its majorities. The main beneficiary has been Reform UK, which has had an excellent night. At this stage, its vote share is well ahead of any other party's. Reform has also made important gains at the expense of the Conservatives, in yet another sign that the traditional Labour-Conservative duopoly is more fragile than ever. The Liberal Democrats have gained majority control of Stockport and Portsmouth, but lost control of Hull, where Reform surged. The Greens have gained votes in many areas, though that has not translated into significant increases in councillors, albeit with their main targets yet to come. What may prove particularly painful psychologically for Labour is that some of the areas where it has done worst are areas represented in Westminster by its most prominent figures. In Tameside in Greater Manchester, the patch of the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner, Labour was defending 17 seats and lost 16 of them, all to Reform, meaning the party lost overall control. In Wigan, where the MP is the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy, Labour lost all 22 seats it was defending to Reform.
Across England, there are still more than 3,000 seats to declare. Average turnout so far is 43%, up 8 percentage points on 2022, when the same seats were last contested. Our political correspondent Harry Farley has been looking at how the parties have reacted to the results so far.
MPs on the left of the Labour Party are publicly putting the blame for their party's struggles at the door of number 10. The former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, told the BBC voters had a personal animosity to Sir Keir Starmer. In private, many more Labour MPs and ministers believe the Prime Minister can no longer lead the party into the next election. But the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, said changing leader would be the wrong response.
You don't change the pilot during the flight. You carry on and you recognise too that governments sometimes, particularly incumbent governments, have it hard. Look, in Australia, they were behind 10 points. They went on to win.
Reform UK has continued its rise and it is the main winner so far. Its deputy leader is Richard Tice.
Results all over the country are a complete rejection of the two main parties, a complete rejection of the smearing, the sneering, the libelling of Reform and the key people within it, and an endorsement of the success of the councils that we've been running.
The Conservatives claim there are early signs of a recovery, but they continue to lose seats and councils to Reform UK. The Liberal Democrats hail their wins in Stockport and Sutton as stonking results, but elsewhere the picture has been more mixed. For the Greens, results from most of their target areas will come later as counting continues throughout the day.
Multiple Labour sources in Wales say they expect the party to lose the Senedd election for the first time since devolution in 1999. Counting will begin this morning. Here's our Wales correspondent, Hal Griffith.
After a campaign where Welsh Labour consistently trailed in third place in the polls, senior party figures now seem resigned to defeat. The Deputy First Minister, Hugh Waranka-Davies, said it had been a tough election for his party with a mood for change, while another former Welsh minister told the BBC Sir Keir Starmer should stand down if the results were as bad as predicted. All this before a single vote has been counted in the 16 newly formed constituencies, which will return 6 members each to the Senedd. Plaid Cymru and Reform led the way in the polls throughout the campaign, but neither is expected to win an overall majority. The first results are due at around lunchtime, but it may be several hours or even days before we know who will govern Wales, with every likelihood of collaboration or coalition negotiations stretching into the weekend.
Counting in the elections for the Scottish Parliament is due to begin in a little under an hour's time, is our Scotland editor James Cook.
In the final hours of campaigning, the SNP leader John Swinney sounded confident of victory, even suggesting his party could win a majority in the Scottish Parliament. But the electoral system makes that difficult. 73 constituency MSPs are elected on a winner-takes-all basis, but another 56 seats are chosen using a method of proportional representation. That means minority or coalition government is the norm at Holyrood, and both Labour's Anas Sarwar and Malcolm Offord of Reform UK insist they could win. The decision not to hold an overnight count in Scotland was taken, in part, to cut costs for councils. A reminder that economic times are tough, and the big issue of this election has been the cost of living.
With his thoughts on the results so far, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
First things first, it's worth emphasising this morning's headlines are only an emerging picture and relate only to parts of England. But that emerging picture points to clear trends, not least substantial progress for Reform and Labour going backwards big time. Both these things were expected, but from the government's perspective, think of it like this. It's one thing to imagine root canal surgery at the dentist, another to actually sit in the chair and have it done, which is what sizeable chunks of the electorate appear to be inflicting on Labour today. It's likely we'll hear from the Prime Minister this morning, attempting to shore up his vulnerable position. The key question for his party in the coming hours and days, to which there is no clear answer as yet, is are wounding defeats a stimulus for gloom and a desire for a change of leadership, or gloom and a collective judgment, now is not the time. Ousting a Prime Minister is, of course, a colossal step, but this is a government confronting towering unpopularity and trying to work out how to respond.
A look at the other news, and the United States and Iran have exchanged fire in the Strait of Hormuz. Despite the attacks, President Trump has insisted the ceasefire between the two countries remains in place. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The US and Iran each accused the other of firing first in a further outbreak of fighting, which once again endangers the four-week-old ceasefire. The Pentagon said US warships in the Strait of Hormuz came under attack from Iranian missiles, drones and fast boats. The US said it retaliated with strikes on Iranian launchers and command sites. The Revolutionary Guard Navy, however, accused the US of violating the truce first with what it called aggression against an Iranian oil tanker and another vessel. American officials are at pains to say the flare-up is not a resumption of the war. But despite Mr. Trump's current apparent preference for dialogue, each of these episodes further erodes the very tenuous peace while Washington and Tehran apply their dueling blockades in the hope of getting better terms in the talks.
A third British national has suspected hantavirus linked to the cruise ship at the centre of the outbreak. The patient is now on a remote South Atlantic island. The vessel MV Hondius is due to reach Tenerife in the next few days. Three people who were on board have died. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
A British man is in a stable condition in the Netherlands after being evacuated from the ship on Wednesday. Previously, a British passenger was evacuated to South Africa, where he remains in intensive care. Now the UK government has announced that a third British national has suspected hantavirus. That person is on the South Atlantic island of Tristan da Cunha. Four other Britons who left the cruise early are on the island of St Helena. They don't have symptoms. It's understood that medical staff will be sent to the islands to provide support.
A special concert will be held at the Royal Albert Hall tonight to mark Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday today. The event will feature music from his programmes, as well as stories and reflections from public figures. It'll be shown live on BBC One at 8:30.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is now 8:10. The people have spoken, and what they've had to say is very hard to listen to for what we used to call the People's Party. Whether in the north, the south, the west or the east of England, Labour is losing councillors and hemorrhaging votes, and the counting
has a long way to go yet. When the votes for the Scottish and Welsh Parliament are counted later today, the party knows it will lose. Again in Scotland, ensuring a third decade in power for the Scottish National Party and perhaps leading to another referendum on Scottish independence. And a first ever win in Wales for Plaid Cymru, a party which also wants to leave the United Kingdom. The debate about how Labour should react has begun after the results came in Hull, where the Reform UK gained 10 new councillors and the Labour Party lost 8. The Labour group leader in Hull, Darren Hale, told us it's time for a change in the leadership.
I think the Labour Party, our MPs and the National Executive of the Labour Party should have a serious look at these results. And I think it's time for leadership change at the top, I'm afraid. I wish Keir Starmer no ill, but I think ultimately he's not the right man for the job to take us to the next level and to obviously secure the benefits that we should have of having a Labour government.
In Hartlepool, in the northeast of England, Reform won all of the seats that were contested yesterday. The Labour MP in Hartlepool, Jonathan Brash, agrees it is time for a change at the top.
That's a terrible night for the Labour Party here in Hartlepool. We're seeing incredibly hard-working, decent Hartlepool people who've contributed a huge amount to the town in their times as councillor, losing their seats, and it's absolutely no fault of their own. For me, you know, I don't like saying it, but it's the reality. I think we need change at the top of the Labour Party. I think the best thing the Prime Minister could do is address the nation tomorrow and set a timetable for an orderly transition.
John McDonnell, who was Shadow Chancellor under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, no friend of the Prime Minister or indeed his political agenda, told us on the overnight election programme that the situation risked being existential for his party.
What I'm advocating is a serious consideration of all the factors that have led us to what is a nightmare tonight. And you can't get away from listing those factors. It is around policy, it's around communication, it's also around, yes, the leadership. And that isn't just Keir Starmer, it's the leadership collectively as well, because it's the Cabinet have made these decisions that I think have been horrendous mistakes. However, the one thing you don't want is a precipitous coup or anything like that. You want the party to have time to take into account all those factors and change it.
And it's just been confirmed that Reform UK have won their first council in London, Havering Borough Council. Nigel Farage of Reform UK is on his way to Havering in order to celebrate his successes. Well, let's talk now to the Defence Secretary, John Healey. Good morning to you, Mr. Healey.
Good morning.
Nightmare's not a bad description, is it?
Well, look, first, huge credit and respect for everyone of all parties who stood. It's a big step to offer yourself for election and for the judgment of others, but especially to Labour candidates who fought a hard and very tough campaign. And look, it is still early. There's a long way to go, as you say. There are places, including councils in London and councils like Lincoln, where I was on Wednesday, where Labour is holding on. But you can't sugarcoat this. It's clear too many good Labour councillors have lost seats, will go on to lose seats today. And I am sorry to those candidates, because I know national sentiment has made their fight much harder. And John McDonnell is right. Of course, there's a need to reflect on this. We have to be honest. There's still a sense for too many people that things aren't getting better fast enough. There's still a sense that they can't trust politics for the future. And that's not a problem of the last 2 years. That's nearly two decades in the making. So we need to work our way back now. And we need, above all, to give people a sense of hope for the future.
When you say reflect on it, will you reflect on what Lord Carwin Jones, former First Minister of Wales, said to us on the overnight election programme? That, and of course he despairs of this, the Labour Party is no longer the party of the working class. That for many people, in many areas of the country, Reform UK now takes that title.
Well, there is that sense for too many, especially working people, that things haven't got better fast enough. But they are seeing, and they have seen, 6 interest rate cuts bringing down mortgage costs. They've seen waiting lists in the NHS down by 400,000. They've seen new labour rights to protect renters from landlords evicting them from home without good reason. And they've seen lowest paid workers given sick pay rights for the first time ever. Is that enough? No. Is that starting to make a real difference to people's lives? Yes. but there's still much more to do. We will do that.
It's not a question of just repeating the list, though, is it? I understand entirely, Mr. Ely, why you want to emphasise the things that you think you've done well and that perhaps you're not given sufficient credit for and are sometimes drowned out by scandals like the Peter Mandelson scandal. But the risk of you repeating them is that people think... He just thinks if he sort of shouts a bit louder, if they talk a bit more often about their achievements, suddenly the public will like it. But another thing John McDonnell said, and I think many people on the programme then agreed with it overnight, is there's an animosity on a scale that we've never seen for a very long time to Keir Starmer. And it's felt on the doorstep. And it may be unfair in your view. It may be unkind in many ways. But it is real and undeniable, isn't it?
In the end, people elect a government because they want to see a change in their lives. And they, in the end, they want to see us doing the job they elected us to do. That's improving their services, their neighbourhoods, their confidence in the future. For me, that starts with security. You can't feel hopeful if you don't feel secure. And so in the face of global conflict and uncertainty, we've got to boost national security. And that means we must spend more on defence. And Keir Starmer has said we will.
He says he will, but he hasn't done it yet. And we're still waiting for the defence investment plan, aren't we?
Well, we have. We've already boosted defence by spending by a record amount since the end of the Cold War. And Keir Starmer said we will spend more faster beyond that. And in the face of economic insecurity, which is really biting on people, we've got to show we're acting on rising costs and business confidence, and we will. And in the face of people feeling unsafe on the streets and online, we've got to act on this insecurity. And you'll hear more from Keir Starmer on that in the days ahead. You'll see more next week in the King's Speech, because we have to work our way back now. We have to give people a greater sense of confidence in the future. For me, that starts with security.
Do you understand why there will be hundreds, it could be well over 1,000 Labour councillors who lose their seats, who may think this sounds like a man in denial? A man just saying, look, you know, steady as she goes, you know, once people see the King's Speech, once they see the defence investment plan, it doesn't reflect what we're seeing, which is that people are prepared to vote for anybody, not the Labour Party. If they live in Wales, they've got Plaid Cymru as a choice. In Scotland, it's the SNP. All over the UK, they're prepared to vote for Reform or the Greens, sometimes the Liberal Democrats, Conservatives. It is anybody but Labour in large parts of this country.
If they've listened to what I've said, they'll know that I'm not in denial. They'll have heard me say we're losing too many good Labour councillors. What they hear is somebody I know, Keir Starmer, shares a determination that we can turn this round. I think we can. We can do that by being bold. We can do that by delivering the changes that people voted for. We can do that by offering a sense of hope for the future. That's a responsibility that we share with Keir Starmer.
If he came out and said to the Cabinet, I've thought about this, my fear is that I will allow Nigel Farage to be our next Prime Minister, I'm going to stand aside and let somebody else who's better at politics, better at governing, got more charisma, you wouldn't object, would you? I mean, that would be a perfectly reasonable thing for him to conclude.
Well, my starting point is that Keir Starmer is one of only four Labour leaders in 120 years that's won an election. And he's won a mandate from the public for 5 years. We're not even halfway through that yet. And my next starting point is that with everything going on in the world, increasing global threats, rising costs, looming oil price crises, the last thing that people should expect to see is a Labour Party turning in on itself, arguing amongst itself.
No, but that's why I asked whether he could come to the conclusion. Apparently, Ed Miliband, according to the Times, said to him quite recently, look, you might want to consider what Tony Blair did, which is to present the party with a timetable and say, let's not have the divisive leadership election you're talking of. I'll give you some notice. I'll say I'm going in a few weeks or a few months' time and allow a civilised conversation in the Cabinet and elsewhere.
Well, I was around during that period, as was Tom Watson, one of the people behind that sort of bid. And he said it wasn't a good thing to do. It's absolutely wrong. Now, people should expect a government at this stage with all the problems that are looming, that's working, demonstrating that we're on their side, working for them and recognising without sugarcoating how serious this judgment of election, local election results is, and to work our way back,
okay,
to turn this round. And we can do that by being bold. We can do that, but we must offer a sense of hope for the future.
John Healey, Defence Secretary, thank you very much indeed. And we expect to hear from the Prime Minister relatively soon, I think.
21 minutes past eight. Let's hear now from Chris Mason, our political editor, who is listening to that. And, yeah, so following on with what Nick was saying about the Prime Minister expected to speak soon, it seems, listening to what John Healey was saying and other Labour people overnight, that although there are people saying there should be this orderly timetable thing now, that actually they are going to resist it.
He's determined to resist it, the Prime Minister. I mean, we should emphasise, shouldn't we, how early in this cycle we still are. 42 councils declared, 94 to go, and that's just in England before the Scotland and Wales picture. I think the Prime Minister's keen to get out and about in the middle or early stages of these results rather than necessarily at the end of them. But he is absolutely determined to make the case, as John Healey, the Defence Secretary on the defensive there, was making, which is this is still early on. The halfway point of the Parliament is Christmas. It is no coincidence that a couple of months ago they decided to schedule the King's Speech, the state opening part of Parliament, for next Wednesday. That is the ultimate relaunch, isn't it, when you have the sovereign involved and the horse and trap and all the regalia and all of that. So that's what they're going to try and tilt attention towards beyond the next 24 hours. It remains fascinating to me to see the psychology of defeat for the Labour Party over the next 24 hours. We've had a smidgen, a sense of it in these early hours. How do they conclude collectively they want to respond to this? Because it's clear that they're deeply unpopular. It's clear that the Prime Minister is even more so. And do they collectively come to the conclusion that they've got to do something about it, or in the end, balk at it? And we shouldn't underprice that in the end they decide that now is not quite the right time for all of the fundamentals that were there a couple of months ago, not being able to agree on who they might want instead, not fancying from their perspective, guaranteed negativity of a contest whilst they're in office. But it's absolutely a live question privately, and you hear murmurings of it, and I think we may get more murmurings of it from some during the course of today. One element that I'm hearing from folk in government, they are, and they're clutching at straws here, but they are relieved that the number of people publicly criticising the Prime Minister so far on the Labour side is not as high as they might have feared it to be.
A practical problem for them if they want to look elsewhere emerging overnight, and I suppose people again probably knew that this was going to happen, but when you sit in black and white and you look at the results when it comes to reform and Labour in the Northwest, and you think, well, what is Andy Burnham's path back? It's not clear, is it?
Not remotely clear. So in big picture terms, it's an exaggeration to say Labour are losing everywhere to everybody, but it's not much of one. So the first is that sense of what do Labour collectively come to the conclusion is to blame here, and which party are they most vulnerable in the direction of? And that's not immediately straightforward. Reform, the Greens, and in other places, others too. And then, as you say, you look at, in particular, that Northwest picture, the picture in Tameside, the picture in Wigan. If you are Andy Burnham, or you're a Labour MP who would quite fancy Andy Burnham being Prime Minister, firstly, that in the short term would tempt you to want to stick with Keir Starmer, or at least not see him bundled out the door too quickly, because the time frame for Andy Burnham to return to Westminster is not straightforward. And neither is any other element of it. There's so many barriers there, isn't there? Finding a seat, being selected by the party, by the National Executive Committee, he didn't clear that hurdle last time, then winning that seat seems far from certain that would be guaranteed almost anywhere, even in some of Labour's strongest of strongholds, given some of the results we're seeing. And then that's before returning to Westminster and the whole shenanigans of a leadership race if it comes to pass. But I do wonder in the internal machinations of the Labour MPs in the coming days, those who are keen on Andy Burnham are in the very short term broadly on the side of the Prime Minister staying where he is, at least in the short term.
James Cleverly from the Conservatives reminding us earlier on that they are still the main opposition party, at least in the House of Commons. They are Her Majesty's opposition.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tricky night for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and they are really a kind of footnote to this story this morning, and likely to be, I suspect, by the end of today. The extraordinary thing from the Conservatives' perspective, from Kemi Badenoch's perspective, she assumes the leadership of a party on its knees after a cataclysmically bad general election result. They then go backwards in the opinion polls and lose MPs. And yet she and they are relatively chipper. She's secure in her position. They'll point to the odd gain that they can, they've made here or there. The reality is they are an opposition party that is going backwards, which is not a comfortable place to be, and then are confronting the reality of this insurgency of reform on the right, and this battle, this tussle to be the flag bearers, the flag wavers, if you like, of the right. Because the argument that Nigel Farage will want to make, he'll no doubt be making in Havering, and he'll, I'd have thought, be making by the end of today when we have the full spectrum of results, is that they, he will argue, are a the dominant party of opposition to the Labour government across Britain, and trying to paint the Conservatives into a corner, as he would see it, marked irrelevance.
OK, Chris, thank you for that. And talking of the full spectrum of results, we will be presenting the programme from Scotland and from Wales when those results are clear tomorrow morning. So even if you don't normally listen on a Saturday, you should.
There is every reason to do so. It is 27 minutes past eight. There's every reason to listen to the sports news because an extraordinary run of results for English clubs.
Yes, Nick, you're right. For the first time ever, there is an English club in each of the three major European finals. You will remember that Arsenal memorably reached the Champions League final earlier this week. Last night, Crystal Palace booked their place in the Europa Conference League final. We discussed that in the last hour of the programme. Meanwhile, in Birmingham, it was an historic night for Aston Villa.
Bypasses Watkins, McGinn again! McGinn in the double! Aston Villa have rattled in a fourth goal! Sheer delirium inside Villa Park! Get the invites ready to Istanbul! Aston Villa, Europa League finalists!
Yes, an emphatic 4-0 semi-final second leg victory for Aston Villa over Nottingham Forest last night propelled them into the Europa League final. Well, delighted to say that the former Villa striker Gary Thompson was at the match last night for BBC WM and joins us live on the programme now. Morning, Gary.
Morning, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. What about you? What a night for Villa, through to their first European final since 1982.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, and you know we don't really like to talk about 82, but now we finally got ourselves back into a cup final. We played the last three Villa games, we have played so poorly, in culminating the Spurs game where we basically gave them the result. So obviously there was a little bit of trepidation about the game last night, but as soon as we started the game, the fans were right behind the Villa players. The Villa players, right from the off, it was the most concentrated performance we've seen for Aston Villa for a long, long time. Played ever so well and thoroughly deserved what they got.
Yeah, Unai Emery made a raft of changes, didn't he, for that Spurs game in the Premier League at the weekend with last night's semi-final in mind. And you have to say that paid off. I want to ask you about one of the key players for Villa, John McGinn, the captain at the double last night. Two goals for him. I mean, when you talk about modern day greats in an Aston Villa shirt, McGinn's got to be right up there.
That's right. When they bought him, I think Steve Bruce brought him in for a couple of million quid, and he weren't too sure how he was going to figure. And obviously in the Championship, John McGinn did very, very well. Looks a very good player. He's such a humble lad, though. By the time you get into the Premier League, he has a chat with Dean Smith, and he's not too sure where you can cut it. Will I get a game gaffer from one of them? And like, we're listening. We see John McGinn play every week, and we know he leads the team. He sparks the team. He's got goals in him. This is the kid that ends up captaining his country. So we're surprised that John McGinn's that worried about his position, or he's that humbled. He doesn't think he can get there. He's gone from strength to strength. Unai Emery has improved every player in the spell he's been here, but none more so than John McGinn. And now they're even talking about a statue of him.
Well, I'm sure that would be very popular indeed. A quick word on the manager, Unai Emery, and his relationship with this competition, the Europa League. He's incredibly into his sixth final in this competition. He's won it four times. There's just something special about the two of them, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to really love this competition. He wants to play in it. As soon as he came to Aston Villa, one of his first press conferences, he said, "Do you know, I'm looking at this team. I think maybe this club, we could get ourselves into Europe." And we thought, it's just a new manager coming in, just spouting as per usual. We ended up in the Conference League that season, ended up in the Champions League the following season, and now in the Europa League. And I think he loved the Champions League, but this is the one he wants. And now we got to the final. We were favourites. We should be favourites against Freiburg. If we play anything like we played the other night as well, we got a great chance.
Yeah, facing the German team Freiburg a week on Wednesday, not long to go to get those tickets to Istanbul, the 20th of May. Former Villa striker Gary Thompson, many thanks for your time this morning. And just to say, Nick and Justin, this news, this Aston Villa news, potentially good news for Bournemouth. Reason being, top five in the Premier League this season will qualify for next season's Champions League. Aston
Villa are currently fifth. But if they win the Europa League, you qualify for next season's Champions League automatically anyway, meaning that additional place in the Premier League will go to the sixth-placed side, which currently, with three games to go in the Premier League, is Bournemouth. So not out of the question that Bournemouth too will be in the Champions League.
I thought season. You were going to say it's particularly good news for His Majesty.
Of course.
Because I'm looking at pictures of the Prince of Wales going yes. absolutely you, potty.
He was there
He's
last
an Aston
night.
Villa fan. Yes. He hugs, he punches the air.
And he was singing Sweet shouts. Caroline at the end. He was joining in at full gusto.
I'm there not sure are. You're allowed to say the Prince of Wales has gone potty, but in certain circumstances.
I will now be led from the building.
Hey-ho, thank you very much for that, Mike. Now, the reunion is coming up in half an hour's time. Kirsty Walk is here with the details.
Ask any cricket fan and they'll tell you that the 2005 Ashes was the greatest test series ever. Freddie Flintoff's bowling heroics, Kevin Peterson's flamboyance with a bat and the inspired captaincy of Michael Vaughan. But what about Aaron Brindle's match-saving 100, the inspired selection of 15-year-old Holly Colvin, Catherine Brunt's destructive bowling and the fire of Ishaguha? The other forgotten Ashes heroes, the England women's team of 2005, back together in The Reunion, this morning at 9 o'clock.
Quick look at the weather now. Areas of cloud and showers for many today. Drier with clear spells tonight.
You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. It is 28 minutes to 9. Let's have a summary of the news from Tom Sanders.
Sir Keir Starmer has said he takes responsibility for what he's described as Labour's tough results in the local elections in England. So far, Labour has lost 8 local authorities and almost 250 seats. Sir Keir said days like this didn't weaken his resolve to deliver the change he'd promised. Reform UK has made significant early gains, winning more than 350 seats in early results. In the past half hour, the party has won one of its key targets, Havering, its first council in London. The Conservatives have also lost ground, losing 140 seats, but have won back Westminster from Labour. The Liberal Democrats and the Greens have made some gains, and there are still more than 3,000 seats to declare across England. Average turnout so far is 43%, up 8 percentage points on 2022. Counting will begin shortly for the elections for the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Senedd. Labour sources have already told the BBC they expect to lose, leaving Wales without a Labour government for the first time since devolution.
Tom, thank you for that. 27 minutes to 9 is the time. Sir David Attenborough is 100 today. We've been hearing from a wide range of people who have known him and worked with him down the years. Now, one of the things that is not widely known about him is that he was, as well as being the nation's preeminent wildlife presenter, he was controller of BBC Two, later actually BBC Director of Programmes, and in those roles he commissioned a really wide range of programmes that went on themselves to be beloved. Civilization, Call My Bluff, Pot Black and Monty Python's Flying Circus. And one of the men given a job by Sir David, therefore, who later became a good friend of his, is Sir Michael Palin. And Sir Michael Palin is here in the studio. Sir Michael, I want to get to your thoughts about him in a second, but let's listen first to you and him, because your friendship blossomed, didn't it, in 2002. You presented this programme profiling Sir David, called David Attenborough Life on Air. And you have this shared love of travel. Let's listen to a bit of the two of you talking about it.
I like about travel, it's somewhere you really want to go to. You say, oh, perhaps you could fit this in. Yeah, it's worth a try.
Yeah.
And it's about enthusiasm too. I mean, if you've somewhere you really want to go to, you can
yeah, there are a number of places I would really want to go to that I haven't been to, so I don't suppose I'd go back to Rama. Or Western Tibet.
Mm.
The forests of southwestern China. I haven't been there.
Have you? No.
What are you doing? Wasting your time.
I'm about 25 series behind you, David.
So, Michael, you and he, I mean, in that clip, there is something similar about you, isn't there? There's that sort of sense of outward boundness, of adventure, of enthusiasm, actually.
Yeah, I think we both shared the same attitude to the programmes and the work we did, which was curiosity. We were curious about the world, him more the natural world, me perhaps more the human world. But that was the way we approached the work. It wasn't it wasn't people looking at us, it was us looking at the world and sort of for the audience, really. And that's always been David's way of doing things. He's not really concerned with personal celebrity at all, but only in a way that enables him to send a message across to people all over the world, which he does very, very well. And I think both of us felt that. You just get on with the job. You try and understand what you're doing, where you're doing, but the people you're talking to and the things you're seeing are the bulk of the programme.
Yeah. And the enthusiasm you communicate, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, yeah. I mean, I think that's what keeps us going. I think in both cases, we love what we do. And, I mean, David is quite remarkable for the amount of times he's been making programmes and the consistency of those programmes. A lot of people sort of, who've been working in television for 60 or 70 years, change the way they do it. They get led away to a bigger sort of presentation or something like that. David has always been consistently clear-sighted and far-sighted in what he does.
And when it comes to clear-sightedness and far-sightedness, that list of programmes that he commissioned, quite apart from Monty Python, Monty Python would be enough alone, but the rest of them as well, extraordinary.
I don't know how he slipped in there. But he rather brilliantly, because when Monty Python first began, we got very grumpy that we were put on late at night and opt-out slots, and people couldn't see the programme that easily. And the only person at the BBC who sort of defended that at all was David Attenborough. We were at some BBC Light Entertainment party, and he came over. And he said, "I gather you've been having a bit of problems. You're a bit fed up with the way you're being programmed." I said, "Well, yes, I suppose we do feel we've been put to one side and put out late at night and all that." And he said, "Well, that's the way you become a cult." And he was spot on. And of course, it shut us up. We were expecting he'd sort of say, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry," but he said, "No." That's the way you're going to become popular.
Was he behind the scenes when you dealt with him and when you deal with him as a friend? He's quite a steely person, isn't he, as well as being? He's got this incredible charm and enthusiasm on camera that you don't get to be Sir David Attenborough without having a certain amount of steel as well.
Oh, no, a lot of steel. I mean, David's presentation in his commentary, which is brilliant, it's very unsentimental, although you get moments where he's doing things that could be rather cosy and with gorillas and all that, but David is completely unsentimental. He puts the facts out clearly as possible. And I think the brilliant skill he has is to make difficult things simple. Not absolutely simple, but put them difficult messages across to an audience who would otherwise be slightly confused. And in the programmes he does, like Ocean and all that, absolutely brilliant. Very, very strong views. Very strong views. Not at all soft.
We are currently, the nation is currently debating what to do about public service broadcasting and specifically as well about the BBC in the longer term. When you look at Sir David's career, that in a sense is the point of the BBC, isn't it?
I think so. I think he's the most remarkable broadcaster. Present company excluded, of the last sort of 60 or 70 years. I mean, and he has been totally loyal to the BBC and knows that he can get his best work done through the BBC. Well, no, he has done a few others, I think.
But is it also that he epitomises things that the BBC feels that it is about? In other words, that there is, as you were saying, there's an unsentimentality, but also sort of an ability to communicate with people that does not talk down to them and puts things out there and says to them, this is important, and isn't afraid to do that.
Yeah, he doesn't talk down to people. He's not pretentious in any shape or form. For him, it is just putting across the information that we need to know, and he does that brilliantly. Partly just because he writes very good commentary, he talks very well, he tells a story very well, he's brilliant with the cadences of his voice. You can sort of go down to a whisper and get everything going, but that's not in a corny way. That's to really get people drawn in to what he's showing them. And what is important for David is that he's showing them the very best, and his teams are wonderful, the very best information he can get on what's happening in the world today.
Sir Michael Palin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The time now is 20 to 9, and Nigel Farage has just arrived at Havering
I'm looking at pictures of it. You can barely see him because there is a wall of photographers in front of him taking his picture for tomorrow morning's front pages, for the front pages of websites here, and I've no doubt around the world as well. He's yet to speak, but he has said overnight in a statement that the elections we've seen mark a historic change in British politics. We can't speak to him now because he's busy talking to the media as a whole, or intending to, but we're delighted to say we can talk to the Treasury spokesperson for Reform UK, the former Conservative who defected to Nigel Farage's party, Robert Jenrick. Good morning to you, Mr. Jenrick, and congratulations on what you must be delighted with as a performance.
Good morning, and thank you very much, Nick. Yeah, look, we're delighted and we're incredibly honoured by the trust that has been given to us by many millions of people across the country. It does feel like a very historic day in which the two old political parties have been comprehensively rejected, the length and breadth of the country, because in different ways they failed. The Tory party said they were going to secure our borders and deliver a strong economy. It did the opposite. Labour said they were going to come in and deliver change. It's just been more of the same. And people have seen in Nigel Farage a strong leader with a team around him as the best bet to fix this country and the mess that we're in right now and put it on a path to future success.
When you say historic, do you believe that he will be our next Prime Minister?
I do. I think what we are witnessing is the biggest change in British political history, at least since the early part of the 20th century, when the old Liberal Party was washed away and the Labour Party was born. And as Nigel said overnight, what is unusual, unique about what's happening is that this is not a traditional left or right battle. It's people who are lifelong Labour voters in somewhere like Wigan coming to Reform. It's people who are lifelong Reform Conservative voters in parts of rural Essex coming over to Reform. And what I think unites these people in all parts of the country is that they do think Britain is broken. And they want to see real change.
Do you accept that you've got to get pretty serious now in a way that you've not previously had before? For example, Reform UK currently has no foreign affairs spokesperson and no defence spokesperson, no real policy on either of those issues either. You have a huge way to go to be even remotely ready to claim to be the next government of this country.
Well, people have said that time and again about Reform, and look what's been achieved in such a short period
of time. Well, no, just answer that point about not having a defence spokesman, not having a foreign affairs spokesman.
Well, I don't think you judge a party on whether or not it has a spokesperson for this or that.
You judge by whether there's someone who's fit to be the next defence secretary or fit to be the next foreign secretary. Who would it be?
Nick, we will be ready for the next general election. We've made enormous progress in such a short period of time. We have the beginnings of our shadow cabinet. More people will be appointed by Nigel in the time to come.
You say
we're
you'll
setting
be ready.
Out policies. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're preparing for government. We've got people joining us all the time who are bringing deep experience from the private sector and the public sector to bear. We're going to be ready whenever that election comes.
Okay, you say that, but these are council elections and we're entitled to judge your party's performance on how it's performed in councils. Let's look a year ago when you took Staffordshire County Council, the first of the good election results for you. The leader of Staffordshire County Council, Reform UK, was accused of racism and quit. His replacement was accused of racism and also quit. You then ended up with no leader at all for many months. The truth is, where you've taken power, it has not always gone to plan, has it?
That's not right. Look, millions of people have voted.
Well, that is literally what happened.
Millions of people have voted Reform, Nick, yesterday, because they're seeing what's happening in local councils and they want a piece of it. They can see that Reform is running these councils well, applying common sense, that
people are coming into local politics.
Well, let's take a look at
what
council tax.
What about the 9% increase in council tax that came in Warwickshire?
That was
County
because
Council.
That was because the Tory party had left a bankrupt council in Worcestershire. Can Reform turn around a bankrupt council immediately? No. Will it do over time? Yes.
Have you cut council tax anywhere?
If you look at council tax, as you raise it, Reform councils in just 1 year in office have increased council tax less on average than the Conservative.
You can't really do a national comparative average with a handful of councils. It's not a meaningful comparison, is it?
If you look at upper tier councils, which are easily comparable, where they're run by Reform, they are at least one percentage point less in council tax than their Conservative and Labour counterparts. So if you want lower council tax, If you want councillors who are going to root out waste, because there is waste in local authorities, it's tough, but there is waste, then you should vote Reform. And that looks exactly what many millions of people have done.
The election's over for now. You can tell us that in a year's time when there are more elections. Let me ask you, though, about another element of being serious about office, and that is being serious about ethics. What do you think first attracted a billionaire cryptocurrency investor to give £5 million to a possible future prime minister who promises to deregulate the business he's making his millions in and then promise to make adverts for a crypto firm? That's what Nigel Farage did.
No, actually, you're talking about a British citizen, a very successful British businessman, who gave money to somebody who was not even standing for Parliament at the time. And had said that he didn't intend to.
You know, and I know he was thinking of standing of Parliament. I interviewed him about it at the time.
I don't know that. He said he wasn't going to.
He said he was thinking about it. I spoke to him at the time. Later changed his mind.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with this.
I'm not asking what's wrong. I'm saying, why do you think the billionaire gave the money?
Because he was very worried about the personal security of Nigel Farage. And look,
you don't think it might have had some connection with the fact that he wants to make even more money in cryptocurrency, and he'd found a man who was willing to promote publicly, whether in Parliament or on his television programmes, his belief that you need to deregulate crypto?
No, none at all.
No connection?
No, I think... Well,
Do you know anybody else who gives £5 million with no strings attached to someone just because they're concerned about their security?
Look, I think the real scandal here, Nick, is the fact that successive governments, Labour and Conservative, have declined to provide proper security to Nigel Farage.
I can assure you, if we were, let me just finish the point.
If we were in government and any Labour or Conservative politician was subject to the level of personal threats that Nigel Farage is, we would ensure that that individual and their family had proper protection. That's never been provided to Nigel. And that is why it was important that this was done.
Do you believe that this billionaire gave £5 million out of his own pocket, out of the goodness of his heart? That's what you want people to believe.
He's a patriotic man who was concerned about the security of Nigel Farage.
No connection with the fact he'd found somebody who wanted to promote his business, promised to deregulate his business, and then invest in his business.
Nigel was not even standing for Parliament, let alone somebody who was a likely future Prime Minister. And do I want this country to be open to the technology of the future like cryptocurrency? Yes, absolutely. Of course I do. I'm Reform's shadow chancellor. I want the UK to be a world-leading hub for cryptocurrency, and our
politicians should earn a lot of money by promoting the causes of people who give them a lot of money. One last question for you. Having discussed that, you were a Conservative, as is well known. Lots of other people were Conservatives. Nigel Farage sat next to Kemi Badenoch at a dinner, somebody being a bit mischievous, sat them together. In the end, however good these results are, for you to reach government, you may well need to reach agreement with the Conservative. Is that something that you think you should be ready to contemplate?
No, absolutely not. Look, there can be no pact or deal. The way to ensure that we get rid of this failing Labour government, whether it's led by Keir Starmer or whoever else in the future, is to rally behind Nigel and Reform. That is what many, many millions of people are doing right across the country, from Wigan to Essex. We'll see it all over the country as results come in. Reform is now the only truly national party and the only vehicle for ensuring that we get real change in this country. That is what we have to do. The Conservative Party, I'm afraid to say, is just going to end up as a regional party in pockets of great affluence in London. It is not a national party anymore. People who voted for him in the past need to rally behind Reform like I did.
Forgive me, lots of other people to talk to. Grateful for your time. No, we couldn't talk to your leader because he's currently speaking to all media outlets, but grateful for your time.
Yeah, and he's not the only one on his feet and speaking out, not the only party leader, because counting, of course, not yet started in Wales or Scotland, and less than half of the English councils having declared. And yet the Prime Minister already feeling the need to declare that he won't be standing down. So in the last few minutes, Keir Starmer acknowledging it's been a tough night for Labour, saying days like this don't weaken my resolve to deliver the change that I promised, acknowledging though as well that mistakes had been made.
But we also made unnecessary mistakes. One of which was that although we were right to level with the public about the scale and depth of the challenges we faced, we didn't do enough to convince them that things will get better, that things will improve. The hope. And that is why in coming days I'm going to set out the steps that we will take to deliver the change that they want and that they deserve. so that every child can go as far as their talent or ability will take them, not held back by poverty. So that every community can have what it needs, a secure, safe place for everybody to live. Households and families not feeling constantly held back by a cost of living crisis. And a Britain where everybody can feel proud of the place where they live and they work. So these are tough results. But tough days like this, they don't weaken my resolve to deliver the change that I promised at the general election. They strengthen my resolve to do so.
Right, that was the Prime Minister talking in the last few minutes. Let us, at 9 minutes to nine, turn to the Greens, who are not yet fully celebrating. Some of their big targets yet to report, but they've certainly had successes. And Sean Berry, the Green Party MP for Brighton Pavilion, is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What would you say about what we've seen so far?
We've seen some really exciting results from the Greens so far. Like you say, our best results are probably yet to come. It's about 90% of our targets still to be counted. But we've seen really exciting breakthroughs in places like Chorley, Salford. We've got gains in places like Exeter, Oxford, Reading. These are places that span the country, and it is looking really good for our big targets later on in the north and in London. And we're looking to make really big gains and see lots more Greens working hard in local councils after this election.
Do you accept that your gains might be capped? Indeed, your support has been at least slightly capped by Zach Polanski sharing that social media post about the police officers who'd been arresting the man in Golders Green, and indeed about the arrests of some of your candidates accused of anti-Semitism.
I think there have been questions on the doorstep, but people have really appreciated the apology that Zach made, the action that the Greens
I'm interested
have
you
taken
say the questions
to
on the doorstep.
So your
experience has been that people have brought it up?
On occasion, yes, but by and large, I was knocking doors almost all of yesterday, and by and large, people who were already voting Green are still doing so. So I think we're going to see some really good results later on.
But have you had a message then from your own supporters? Would you say that you've had a message from your own supporters about that kind of thing and about their disapproval of it?
I think people had questions, but they were also really happy to talk about it, and they understand that we have an awful lot of scrutiny going on at the moment to us, and that some of it has been quite unfair and some of it has
been
apologised for. So I think, you know, people want to hear a politics of hope. They are understanding that the fever pitch that there has been, the very negative campaigning throughout this election, isn't necessarily what they want to vote for. And our candidates on the ground, working hard all year round, people who are already in local councils getting re-elected because they work hard for their local communities, and people offering real hope on the ground, are getting the votes that they deserve, because we are working hard for that. We're actually responding to what people tell us they need, which is action on their cost of living, action for housing, action to support their local environment. And that's what Greens are going to be working for.
Sean Berry, Green Party MP for Brighton Pavilion. Thank you.
It is 7 minutes to nine. As we've been saying, Nigel Farage, Reform UK leader, followed the tradition of party leaders of heading to one of the places that you've had a victory. So the cameras have got the images for the evening news bulletins. Mr. Farage has been there for quite a while. He's still speaking there. But let's have a listen to what he said when he was havering about what he considers to be a seismic election.
Overall, what's happened is a truly historic shift in British politics. We've been so used to thinking about politics in terms of left and right. And yet what Reform are able to do is to win in areas that have always been conservative, but equally, we're proving in a big way, we can win in areas that Labour have dominated, frankly, since the end of World War I. At the moment, we're winning 1 in 3 of all the seats that are up, but I genuinely think the best is yet to come. I'm very excited about the North East results, the Yorkshire results, some more to come in the West Midlands. Essex, we're feeling supremely confident, and that's significant given that half the Shadow Cabinet have seats in Essex. So it's a big, big day. It's a big, big day, not just for our party, but for a complete reshaping of British politics in every way.
reshaping of British politics from a man who now makes clear that he believes he can and will be the next Prime Minister of this country. Let's talk to two followers of politics who will be writing their accounts of what they think has taken place in the last 24 hours and indeed what will take place over the next 24 or so. Pippa Crerar, a political editor at The Guardian. Tom McTague, editor of The New Statesman. Good morning to you. Could I ask you both, first of all, do you now believe at the end of what we've seen so far that Nigel Farage could be our next Prime Minister, Tom McTague?
Could he be? Absolutely. I think he's now probably the favourite to be the next Prime Minister as well, or at least the next Prime Minister after the next election. And that is the other question that hangs over British politics, of course, the future of Keir Starmer and the next Labour Party leader. So there's so much to happen in British politics. I don't think we can predict anything, but we have to just acknowledge the facts this morning that Nigel Farage is the runaway winner from last night's elections, and he is the favourite to be the next Prime Minister.
Pippa Crerar, of course, I'm making a mistake in the sense that Tom, sort of acknowledged there that Keir Starmer might be replaced. There might be another Prime Minister before Nigel Farage gets a crack at it in a general election. But do you think he's possibly a Prime Minister after the election?
Keir Starmer or...
No, Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage. Yeah. I think it's likely that he will be, or it's possible that he could be leading the biggest party going into the election. I think one of the things that we've seen overnight so far is Reform haven't yet capped that 30% vote share. That might change by the end of counting over the next couple of days. But as things stand, it looks like the support could be capped. And therefore, I think it's more likely that he could be leading the biggest party and have to do some sort of deal with another party, possibly the Conservatives. But we're probably more on course if you were to sort of have an election tomorrow, we're more on course for hung parliament territory rather than Nigel Farage romping home to Downing Street.
Well, let's turn to the more immediate question then, Pippa, which is, do you think Keir Starmer can carry on for very long, not necessarily just a day or two, for very long as leader of the Labour Party?
I think that's where there's a big question mark. And it's absolutely the case that he's determined, as we've heard this morning, to stay put. His cabinet have warned that they think that now is not the time to oust him, given the economic uncertainty, given the global picture, and given that there's not an easy course or an obvious successor for him to take over. They think doing it this far from a general election would be a bad idea. And I've been saying as much to Labour MPs who are obviously agitating for Keir Starmer's departure, many of them, not all of them, it must be said. But there's, of course, there's always the option, there was the possibility of unintended consequences. It is a big gap between how people feel about the results and their expectations. And Labour MPs are expecting the results to be terrible. But when they actually feel those results and see councillors, friends in their own patches often losing seats over the course of the day, worrying about their own future, does that sort of anxiety manifest itself in sort of really serious plotting and so on? It could happen. I think Keir Starmer is probably safe for now. But pretty much everyone I've spoken to in the Labour Party, including some of his closest allies, suggests that it is unlikely that he's going to be the Prime Minister that takes the party into the next election. But I think we'll have to wait until a bit closer to that election for that to actually happen.
Tom McTague, in the parallel situation, some parallel at least, Margaret Thatcher did very badly in May local election. She didn't go straight away, but by the November she was gone in 1990. Is that what you expect to happen to Keir Starmer?
I think that's the most likely scenario. If you talk to Labour cabinet ministers privately, they are angry, they are looking at their options, they are plotting, they do not think he can lead their party into the next election. And it's a question of timing for a lot of them. When do they make the move? When is it best for themselves to make the move if they have leadership aspirations? So there's a lot of kind of calculating going on here. But you raise the Thatcher point. You know, sometimes...
Just a few seconds, Tom.
Somebody just challenges the leader and it changes things.
Yeah. Tom McTague, editor of The New Statesman. Pippa Crerar, political editor of The